It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Happy birthday, Mama Monster. This is episode 679 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 22nd, 2020. Undertaker is not the only one celebrating 30 years this month. If you are a fan of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and you have not seen the 30th anniversary reunion special on HBO Max, you need to go watch it. Very well done, that James Avery tribute they had. They were sitting around watching a tribute. Of course, he passed away a number of years ago. It's just a shame he couldn't be there to celebrate with the rest of them, because he really was the heart and soul of that show, I think, every bit as much as Will Smith was. But I thought it was really well done, so go check that out if you have not already done so. It is Survivor Series Sunday, so we have a lot of Survivor Series stuff to talk about. Did predictions the other day, but there have been changes. There have been changes since I last, and I figured there would be. Now we have a kickoff match, so we're going to get into all that. We're going to run through everything again with some new things sprinkled in. But if you would like to support the podcast, as you all know, you may make a PayPal donation anytime you wish. On thesolomonster.com, you see the right-hand side of the page, there's that little PayPal button, that is the place to go. $10 or more, get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the air. $30 or more if you want to promote a podcast or some other business venture that we can talk about. But I want to say thank you to everybody who has supported this week, including the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar. I've been seeing his name pop up a lot on the streams and everything, so I hope Nayef is doing well. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Josh the Shooter Stockton, Killshot Keith Hart, the Wichita Lineman Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, and belt fan Brent Banner, who says, in honor of The Undertaker's 30th anniversary, he will be dropping a special Survivor Series Elimination Tournament with his friend Kyle Webb, with a classic red NWA TV Championship belt on the line. There will also be a special Top 5 Undertaker Survivor Series Matches countdown video. And both of them are going to be available today on YouTube. Just go to youtube.com/surreal469. That's youtube.com/surreal469. And last but certainly not least, we've got Jeff Lippman. Jeff and Shaw host a podcast together called The Garden of Doom. It's a variety magazine that talks about the unexplained, talks about the abnormal. Just perfect for a wrestling audience, right? We're all kind of abnormal in our own way. Pop culture, current events, if you like that kind of stuff, if you like myths and comics and sci-fi, check out the Garden of Doom podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, and all major podcast platforms. We have a brand new sponsor this week that I am very excited to talk about. I'll talk about them a little bit later. I just want to say thank you to all the people who have used our code. We have different codes, right, for different sponsors to try to get you guys some money off. And yeah, other services like ExpressVPN. You've heard me talk about ExpressVPN, which I've used before and been using for a while. And I know some of you have found something like that to be very useful. But when you tweet me about it, some people will tweet me about it. They'll tag them in it. It really helps the show because it shows our sponsors that, you know, we have an audience that is engaged and actually finds benefit in what they're offering. So keep doing that, because it allows me to then share your feedback and your tweets with them when we speak every month. So I just wanted to say thank you for supporting in that way. And also, we are heading into the biggest sale of the year on Pro Wrestling Tees, the Black Friday week sale. It's coming up. It's Black Friday's almost here. You can get 20% off all shirts in our Sound Off store. And it could not come at a better time with that new 13-year anniversary shirt up in the store. It begins this Tuesday, November 24th at 1 p.m. Eastern, straight on through Monday, November 30th. So this is not a Black Friday sale. It's a Black Friday week sale. And you can just shop on the Sound Off store page, grab the new shirt or any of the shirts on there, and get 20% off. Just go to prowrestlingtees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Again, that is starting this Tuesday. I thought it was very amusing reading the item in this week's Observer about how stressful it was backstage at SmackDown 2 weeks ago after Vince McMahon ripped up the entire show and completely rewrote it himself, and the writers and the producers, they knew nothing about what was happening. They knew nothing. There's a live show that night. They knew nothing about what was happening until Vince McMahon walked in with the final script that day. And it seems like we're hearing stories like this weekly or almost weekly now. And I say it was amusing because I had just read this week that WWE put up a new job posting on LinkedIn, looking for a new head writer. They are seeking a new lead creative writer. So if you are looking for a job, and I know many people are, but if you are looking for a job where, you know, your boss will simply rip up your work every week and do it himself, then boy, do I have the dream job for you. This is a little descriptor here. The lead writer will have the opportunity to manage, mentor, and develop experienced writers and producers with a diverse creative background while simultaneously being accountable for compiling, editing, and developing weekly and long-term scripts, storylines, and character development. So, if you have 10-plus years of TV or film writing experience, and you are a masochist, you can apply for the position on the WWE corporate website right now. So there you go. That's for those of you who think that you qualify and would like to take on that kind of responsibility. WWE Survivor Series is tonight, the final pay-per-view from the Amway Center in Orlando. WWE announced this week that the Thunderdome is moving to Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg, Florida, starting with the December 11th episode of SmackDown. With the NBA season starting soon, they had to leave. Basically, they're being kicked out. And Tropicana Field is an indoor stadium. It's where the Tampa Bay Rays play. That will make this, I mean, if we assume that that is where pretty much all of the events are going to be between now and WrestleMania, then that would make this upcoming Royal Rumble the third Rumble in a row to be held inside of a baseball stadium, although this will be very different because there will be very little, if any, fans in attendance at this Rumble. I still think they'll try to get some in there. Limited capacity, kind of the way that AEW does, but who knows? Who knows where we're going to be in January? But Florida seems like they're taking a very hands-off approach. So we might yet get some bodies in the building for the Rumble, people counting down, right? 10, 9, 8, all that stuff. It's kind of part of the Rumble every year. There have been some changes, as I mentioned, to the card since I did my prediction stream on Thursday night. And thank you to everybody who joined me live. Always fun to interact with you guys on there. So I'm going to run through all the predictions here. But first, tonight is the final farewell to The Undertaker, with today being the 30th anniversary of his Survivor Series debut in 1990, which, yes, I am going to cover that and a whole lot more in the history segment. We got a packed history. There's a lot of shit that happened this week, and a lot of stuff that happened at Survivor Series. So we'll get to that a little bit in more detail in the history segment a little bit later on. But, my God, Undertaker has been everywhere this week. He was on Hot Ones, which is the same show that Sasha Banks had got her noticed by Jon Favreau and got her a role on The Mandalorian. That role that she got, that's how she got the spot. True story. It wasn't all the years spent on WWE television as Sasha Banks. It was a 20-minute appearance on a YouTube show eating hot wings. And that is how she ended up on The Mandalorian. But Undertaker made his appearance on there, which was fun to watch. They also announced a clothing collaboration with Undertaker and Snoop Dogg. Speaking of Sasha, Undertaker and Snoop did an Instagram live chat last night, which I missed, but I did see one little clip where Undertaker said that WrestleMania 25 was, and I quote, the shit. I didn't see him smoking any. Of course, Snoop was. I didn't see Undertaker smoking anything. But Undertaker said WrestleMania 25 was the shit. Undertaker joined TikTok this week. Put his first TikTok up with him and his wife. He joined Cameo for a limited run of 30 personalized videos. And as of yesterday, as of last night when I checked, he sold them all out. Each one for the low price of just $1,000. So you're perhaps somebody is listening to this right now and you were one of the lucky ones to get in on that. And you spent $1,000. To get a personalized cameo from The Undertaker. So that's 30 cameos at $1,000 a pop. $30,000. I don't know how much of that cut cameo gets. I don't know how much of that cut WWE gets. So how much ends up in Undertaker's pocket, I'm not sure. But Undertaker gets to do cameo. I assume because that was a WWE-driven thing. 30 years of keeping the mystique of the character alive. And in the span of a week, I mean, I know it's been going on for a while with the documentary earlier this year, but it feels like in the last week or so, it's as if they just said, yeah, fuck it. You know, if we're going to do this, we're just going to go all the way. Unbelievable. I also watched the Brothers of Destruction special on the WWE Network. Part 2, by the way, of the Broken Skull Sessions. Him sitting down with Stone Cold Steve Austin. That is dropping, if it's not on the network by now, it is going to be at some point today, and I am looking forward to checking that out. That's actually the part of this whole Undertaker month of content on the network that I've most been looking forward to, is the second sit-down with Austin. But the Brothers of Destruction special, it was good, it was really good. It was just Undertaker and Kane, Mark and Glenn, sitting down in an empty auditorium, sitting kind of in a little recliner almost, or a chair, opposite each other on a stage, just talking about their careers and how their careers intertwined in the genesis of the Kane character, the matches they had, the people they work with. I thought the most interesting part of it was just hearing Kane and hearing them talk about the end of the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania 30. Kane was watching from the back, and when it happened, his thought was the same as my first thought, being there live in the building, which was, I thought the referee had botched the count, especially when they didn't play anybody's music. There was a lot of confusion, and I'm thinking, oh boy, how are they going to get out of this? And Kane felt the same way until he realized, nope, that was the finish, and he was so upset about it, he stormed out of the room. And it's funny, because Austin has told the story, he had the same reaction, he was in the truck with Kevin Dunn, and when he saw the finish, he was disgusted by it, and he also stormed out, and couldn't believe it. Undertaker said, when he got to the building that day, he was going over. There was a lot of discussion about the finish, there was a lot of discussion about who was going to win in the days leading up to it. When he got to the building that day, in the first few hours he was there, he was winning that match. He was beating Brock Lesnar. And then at some point mid-afternoon, Vince McMahon, in he walks, and he says Vince never came to his dressing room. If anything, people would come and say, hey, Vince wants to talk to you, and they would summon him to go see Vince. So when he saw Vince McMahon walking into the room, he knew. Uh-oh. And Vince stated his case, and he told Undertaker, look, we're going a different way with this. Brock's going over. His first reaction was, are you sure? Because I don't think Brock needs it. And Vince said, I'm sure. And that was it. And Undertaker said, well, if that's what you think is best, then that's what we'll do. But it's just amazing when you hear stories like that, because that will go down as one of the most storied, fabled finishes to a match in WWE history. I mean, really, the three that I think of Montreal, the end of the streak, especially given everybody's reactions to it when it happened. And I guess if you're an older fan, then, you know, the night that Bruno Sammartino lost the championship, you know, you could hear, supposedly you could hear a pin drop. It was so shocking. But those are the ones, really. Those are like the most infamous kind of match finishes in the company history. And to think that the decision was just almost like randomly made only a few hours before the match. It wasn't as if they knew days and weeks in advance, okay, this is what we're going to do. It was almost just on a whim. And that's how it all went down. But overall, the special I thought was very good. So you should all check it out if you have a few minutes. I think it was about 45 minutes. They are bringing in some special guests for The Undertaker's big farewell tonight. I don't know if these people or all of them are going to be on camera. I would assume that they'll be featured in some way or shown. Doesn't mean they're going to be in the ring with him or get an entrance. I'm sure they must be filming some kind of documentary footage with them for the network. Savio Vega is going to be there. The Godfather is going to be there. Rikishi, the Godwins, Henry and Phineas. What do they all have in common? What do all four of those guys have in common? They were all part of the Undertaker's Bone Street crew. BSK. All of them and Yokozuna, who's no longer with us, they were all part of that crew, and all the BSK boys are being brought in for the show tonight. Kurt Angle is expected to be there. And, of course, Kane. But that's hardly a surprise that Kane would be in attendance. When I did the stream the other day, floated an idea for what I thought might go down. Not necessarily the idea that I would love to see. I don't think Retribution should be within 50 feet of The Undertaker. But I do think, you know, they don't have a role on the show tonight. I saw they hacked the WWE Twitter account the other day. Ooh. Yeah, they hacked the Twitter. They did get a win, a rare win on Raw the other night, but they have no match. And so what if the role of Retribution on the show is to interrupt The Undertaker's final farewell and surround the ring and either attack or tease an attack and the lights go out and out comes the Fiend? Who also, by the way, has no role and has no match on this show. The Fiend and Alexa Bliss, and Alexa can take out Mia Yim, and the Fiend sort of helps The Undertaker, not that he needs it, but he helps The Undertaker lay waste to all the members of Retribution, and we get a moment. Call it whatever you want. We get some kind of moment together in the ring on screen with The Undertaker and the Fiend, The Undertaker in the 1,000 interviews that he has done in the last few weeks has talked about the fact that he kind of wishes he had the chance to work at some point with the Fiend. Some very dark similarities there, I guess, if you look at the two characters. But that would be a way to kind of get them together without doing a match. Undertaker gets a little action in there instead of just doing a speech and waving goodbye to all the virtual people on the screens. I could definitely see that idea playing out. The more I hear The Undertaker talk, it really does sound in his head, in his mind, like he is convinced that this is it. But again, he's been convinced of this before. He talked about this in the documentary where when he had that really good tag team match last year, it was him and Roman Reigns against Shane McMahon and Drew McIntyre. And that was a nice rebound from the previous Undertaker appearance. He's on camera backstage after the match going to Vince and saying, I'm done. That's it. I'm finished. I can't go anymore. And he ended up coming back anyway, which is why, again, I remain unconvinced that there won't be that phone call that comes in 6 or 9 months or a year from Vince McMahon saying, hey, I got an idea. Whether it's a match, whether it's a cinematic match, I've got an idea. Can you take 3 months or 6 months to start working out? And then Undertaker says, okay. Because he's got this weird sense of loyalty. I understand that the Undertaker character was Vince McMahon's brainchild. He has had an amazing career. He's made a great living for himself. So I understand having some sense of loyalty to the man who maybe you give a lot of that credit to. But it is this bizarre sense of loyalty where he feels as if he owes the man something. He doesn't owe him anything. Not after 30 years. His body is thrashed. But because of that loyalty, Do I believe that this is the last time that we will see The Undertaker in the ring? I don't, but I think he thinks it is. I think he's convinced. I think he's perfectly content to just kind of ride off into the sunset and, you know, just continue to do interviews or maybe coach or do something like that. But is Vince McMahon convinced that this is the end? That I'm not so sure of. 2 years ago, Raw embarrassed SmackDown at the Survivor Series. It was a clean sweep of wins for the Raw brand on the main pay-per-view card. Last year, NXT was the winner in the battle for brand supremacy, but multiple COVID outbreaks may have been what took them out of the running and took them out of the show this year. SmackDown has been a much easier watch on most weeks. Not every SmackDown is great, but SmackDown, by and large, has been a pretty quality show for a while now, certainly more so than Raw, which is very up and down, to say the least. I think SmackDown goes over this year. I don't think it's a clean sweep. I don't think it's a blowout. But I'm going to say that SmackDown wins. Now wins what exactly? I don't know. Really nothing. They don't win it. They don't win a damn thing. And that's really too bad because Survivor Series this year could have been billed, and really every year Survivor Series could be billed as one of the most important nights of the year if WWE wanted it to be, and they just don't do it. Although I do have a good feeling about tonight's card on paper, I think the matches are going to carry this show. I have a feeling it will end up exceeding expectations because I don't get the sense people have very high expectations as it is for this show. But again, it's a shame because this really could be one of the most important shows of the year if there was something tangible on the line, and it's not that hard to do, and they just don't do it. So it just feels like just another show. That's not what Survivor Series should be. But that's what it has become. Now, the kickoff match has been announced. It will be a dual-branded battle royal. A battle royal with nothing on the line, the epitome of laziness. Although I suppose when the pay-per-view goes on the air, they could announce that there's something on the line. They should. They should put something on the line. I liked my idea better that I pitched on Thursday, which was Otis representing SmackDown, one-on-one against Tucker. Yes, Tucker the Job Guy, representing Raw. Just to give some closure to that story. And it's an excuse to do one more Raw versus SmackDown match. Otis can have Chad Gable, his new mentor, his new coach, in his corner. It would be a win for Otis, a win for SmackDown. That would have been a better idea. They decided to go a very different way. Otis is on this show. I'm going to get to him in a little bit. Team Raw, WWE Women's Tag Team Champions Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler teaming up with Lacey Evans, Peyton Royce, and Lana, taking on Team SmackDown of Bianca Belair, Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, and filling the final two spots are the two women that I predicted on Thursday, because I did the predictions before SmackDown aired. It did, in fact, turn out to be Bayley and Natty. And it only made sense, because they needed some heels. It was a complete babyface team. You needed some heels on the team. Natty's been trying week after week after week to qualify. She finally got in. Bayley, longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion of all time. No match on the show. So it only made sense that they would get the final two slots. Mandy Rose was supposed to be in the match on Team Raw with Dana Brooke. Mandy suffered a legitimate shoulder or arm injury of some kind. It might have been on a spot with Nia Jax a couple of weeks ago, which, again, I don't blame Nia for that. I think it was just a matter of Mandy was being thrown through the ropes out of the ring, and when she went to grab the rope, she missed the rope, and she landed on her shoulder very hard on the apron. I assume that's where the injury happened. Otherwise, I have no idea where this injury would have happened, but it was likely on that spot. So they had to get her out of the match. They took Dana out of the match as well, although she's not hurt. And so we ended up with Lacey, and we ended up with Peyton getting the shot. Now, on SmackDown, Adam Pearce is the one who named Bayley to the team. So kind of the way that, I guess, Bret Hart didn't really need to qualify for the King of the Ring in 93, which he went on to win. He just sort of was put into the tournament. Everybody else had to wrestle a qualifying match. Bayley did not have to wrestle a qualifying match. Natty did. She had to wrestle against Tamina. Not sure what we did to deserve that, but she wrestled Tamina. She got the tap out win. Natty is in the match. Bayley is already acting like it's her team. She's the team captain. It's my team. I don't think Bianca Belair is going to have much of this. She's not going to have any of it. I think one causes the other to be eliminated. Because it's easy to look at this and go, Bianca Belair should be either the sole survivor or one of the sole survivors. Maybe it comes down to her and Bayley. Maybe her and Bayley win the match for Team SmackDown. And Bayley, of course, is jumping up and down saying, I won, I won. I'm the winner. And then you can kind of go from there. Because I do think the end result here is coming out of this pay-per-view is a program. And at least one, if not a couple of pay-per-view matches between Bianca and Bayley. It only makes sense. I think Bianca needs at least one person with credibility to feud with and to beat if there is any chance of her going on to WrestleMania to challenge for the championship. I mean, I guess she could always win the Women's Royal Rumble match. That's an easy way to punch her ticket. But if not, she's got to beat some people with credibility. Bayley has credibility. She can beat Bayley, then she can go on to challenge Sasha for the title of WrestleMania, which is where I think this should be headed. So I'm not fully convinced of my pick here, because I think Team Raw is going over. But could I envision Bianca and Bayley being the sole survivors for Team SmackDown? Yeah, I could see that. But I'm going to predict Lana is the sole survivor for Team Raw. That's where I think all of this Lana stuff is leading to. She's been put through a table 9 times in a row on TV. Tonight would be the 10th time. And I think it happens, but it happens mid-match, so she's not eliminated. But people sort of forget about her, or they're supposed to forget about her. Lana's been put through a table again, and the match rolls on. And then, out of nowhere, comes Lana when we think the match is over and Team SmackDown or Bayley maybe thinks she has the match won. And then she gets rolled up, the shock roll-up. They love their roll-ups. And Lana gets the win for Team Raw. The person that people least expect is the one who goes over and wins it for Team Raw in the end. I actually think it would make more sense if she rolled up Natty, because her and Natty used to be partners. The last time we saw them together on TV was on Raw. Natty was just berating this woman for losing. So, Bayley or Natty, either one of them really, makes sense for them to think they won, get rolled up, and they get embarrassed and pinned by Lana. So that's how I see that unfolding. Lana also just got the WWE Chronicle treatment on the network. So, in a way, she's kind of being featured right now, so her going over would kind of make sense. United States Champion Bobby Lashley, one-on-one, representing Raw, against the Intercontinental Champion Sami Zayn, representing SmackDown. We have ourselves heel versus heel. No investment in this match. It's certainly not like Daniel Bryan against Brock Lesnar a couple of years ago, which that was also Raw versus SmackDown, heel versus heel. Although Bryan had just turned heel. I mean, that like 2 days before the pay-per-view. So I think there were still a lot of people cheering for him during the match. That is one rare example that they have done of heel versus heel, where it was just this incredible match. I just don't think it works here. There's no story that, like, there's no reason to get behind either one of these guys. You can get behind Lashley because you think this guy's a machine. He just, you know, it's cool. Him and the Hurt Business, they're cool. And Lashley just goes around wrecking dudes. But, you know, they're both heels, and I don't know that anybody really is going to be cheering too hard for either one of them. No titles on the line. I think Sammy ekes out the win, because people just assume Lashley is going to destroy this guy. Sammy, I think, will somehow manage to pick up the win here for SmackDown. We have the Raw Tag Team Champions, The New Day, meeting the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, the Street Profits. I've said it before, I'll say it again. This should have been a title unification match, but it is not. And I still think that the younger team goes over here. The Street Profits have been acting very cocky, very arrogant. I just don't see what is really gained by New Day winning other than them just wanting a team from Raw to get the win. So, you know, if they want Raw to go over on this pay-per-view, then it's another win for Raw. Then I guess the New Day would have to win. But I think the Street Profits, this would be a big win for them. They get a win over the New Day, as established as the New Day has been now for years. 10-time tag team champions. I think it would be more meaningful for the Street Profits to get this win than it would hurt the New Day to take the loss. So I'm going to pick the Street Profits. We've got the Raw Women's Champion Asuka going one-on-one with the SmackDown Women's Champion Ms. Mandalorian herself, Sasha Banks. This will be their fifth meeting on TV since July. They had two pay-per-view matches, two TV matches, all championship matches. This is not for the championship. This match actually means less than any of those other four. But it will be their fifth meeting. The one thing about Sasha and Asuka, they always have very good, if not great, matches together. I don't think this will be any different. Carmella has been a thorn in Sasha's side. She attacked Sasha again on TV and left her laying on SmackDown Friday night. I think for her to interfere and attack Sasha again would be kind of repetitive at this point. So maybe she attacks after, or she tries to, but Sasha stops her and actually, you know, beats the hell out of her. I just hope it doesn't impact the finish of the match. I'd like to keep Carmella out of this and just let these two go in there and have a match. And I think Sasha wins. I think Sasha gets her revenge. The last time that her and Asuka met, she had back-to-back losses to Asuka in August. SummerSlam and the night after SummerSlam in that Lumberjack match. I think Sasha avenges those losses here. And she has opponents, and not just Bianca. Obviously, she's going to have a program with Carmella. There might be maybe one more after that, and then I hope they start to build to her and Bianca at WrestleMania. Asuka is a little bit different because it's just not obvious where she goes next. It really does feel like they're treading water until Charlotte is ready to come back, and even that's not an answer. You know, bringing Charlotte back and immediately putting her back into the women's title match, I don't know that that's exactly a great move either. And her and Asuka is a match we've seen done, a whole bunch of times. So I think it's time to get some new blood in that division. And I think her name is Rhea Ripley, based on what we saw on NXT on Wednesday night. Feels very much like there may be a move coming very soon, possibly as soon as tonight. Tonight or tomorrow, we could see that move. But I think Sasha wins here. Team Raw, AJ Styles, Keith Lee, Sheamus, Braun Strowman, and Dopey himself, Matt Riddle. That's the name he gave himself. He calls himself Dopey. Little inside joke there, right? Taking on Team SmackDown, Kevin Owens, Jey Uso, Baron Corbin, Seth Rollins, and then there was a spot open. And I thought, perfect spot for Big E. Big E has been kind of cold. He's not really been featured in many weeks in any kind of prominent role on SmackDown. He's just doing stuff in the back with the Street Profits. And he really has been promoting the New Day tag team match more than anything of his own. And he's not even a part of New Day anymore. Or I guess he is. He is technically still a part of New Day, but they're not, you know, they're not together. But perfect spot for Big E. Maybe he even goes on to be the sole survivor. Look who's opposing them. Look who's on the opposite team. Sheamus. He just came out of a program with Sheamus. So again, it kind of makes sense for them to be part of the same match. Nope. It's not Big E. Not Big E. It's not Lars Sullivan. It's not even Daniel Bryan, who would have made a lot of sense for that final spot. Daniel Bryan is the man who beat Jey Uso, who is in this match. He beat Jey Uso on Friday night. He avenged his loss from many weeks ago to Jey Uso. Daniel Bryan has been left off of this show. Would have added more star power to the match. Brian, by the way, he cut a great promo on Talking Smack yesterday. Talking about not being satisfied with a small package. He is Mr. Small Package. Not being satisfied with a small package victory over Jey Uso. So that issue is clearly far from over. I think they could be grooming Brian for a match with Roman Reigns a lot sooner than WrestleMania. But if he was beating Uso on Friday night, then there's no reason that he should not be part of this Survivor Series team. But it's not Big E and it's not Daniel Bryan. It is Otis. Yes, the same Otis who already had a match to qualify against Seth Rollins and lost. He lost his qualifying match. Now, I know on Raw they had a second chance qualifier, but at least there was a match. Here, Adam Pearce said, "Hey, Otis, I like you, brother. You're on the team." And I'm like, what? This doesn't make any sense. But Otis is on the team. So I am not happy about that. I mean, not that I hate Otis, but there were people who would have been better in that spot. And even just the way that they did it was the epitome of laziness. So Otis is on the team. I even said, you know, they had Murphy and Rollins on SmackDown Friday night. And they had, yeah, they had a good match. And Murphy got the win, but Rollins is on Team SmackDown tonight. Murphy is not. That's why I had suggested that Rollins ends up, you know, because he was so furious with rage at Murphy, he's not thinking straight. He puts his spot at Survivor Series. He's so confident that he's going to beat Murphy, I will put up my spot on Team SmackDown. And that way, when Murphy wins, he gets the spot. Rollins, it sounds like Rollins is going away for a few weeks soon anyway. I mean, tonight could be his last night before he goes away. So by virtue of the win on Friday night, Murphy then could take his spot. And now Murphy gets a nice prime position on the team at Survivor Series. It's just a lot of very bizarre decisions that just don't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me. I just think there was a better way of going about putting these teams together. As far as who goes over and who I think gets the win, I'm going to go with Team SmackDown. This is the one where I think I'm going to end up being wrong. Team Raw lost to Retribution. I mean, they should all just retire at this point. They lost to Retribution on Monday night. Very good chance they'll end up winning tonight, but I'm still sticking with my pick. I am sticking with Team SmackDown. Although, once they put Otis on the team, I mean, to me it was like, maybe I should change my pick, but fuck it. I'll just keep it the way it is. And then we have the WWE champion. The new WWE champion. Like the new Daniel Bryan. We have Drew McIntyre one-on-one with the Universal Champion Roman Reigns. Drew McIntyre regained the title from Randy Orton in Orton's first title defense on Raw last Monday night. It was the third time in 4 years that the WWE title has changed hands right before Survivor Series. But you could argue that it was the fourth straight year. If you count Brock Lesnar beating Kofi Kingston in 8 seconds on that first SmackDown on Fox episode in October of last year. Now, October, it is the month before Survivor Series, but it's not like 2 or 3 weeks before Survivor Series, so I don't know if you want to count that one or not. It is still strange, though, that the WWE title the last 4 years in the fall has been changing hands quite a bit. It's been playing hot potato, bouncing from one person to the other. I would have held off on doing this match longer, but I will say that this is a way more appealing match to me than Orton against Reigns would have been. It's also babyface against heel, which just works a lot better. On SmackDown, they had a contract signing where Roman Reigns literally sat at the head of the table, which I like that. That's one of those little, points that I liked. He told Drew that he believed that he could do it. He believed that he could beat Randy Orton. Paul Heyman didn't believe it. Paul Heyman didn't think he could pull it off. But Roman said, "I knew you could beat Randy Orton." Roman said that, you know, "I've already learned all of these different lessons." He goes, "You're the right guy in the right place at the wrong time." Which I guess you could also say that about Roman Reigns 5 years ago, right? Right guy, right place, wrong time. And he suffered for a long time with the fans because of that. Not his fault. So he has learned these lessons himself in the past. Drew offered Reigns a piece of advice of his own and said, please underestimate. I want you to. Please underestimate me. And take your last 2 days of peace to prepare for war. And Roman took umbrage to the idea that Drew was giving him advice. And he said that Paul Heyman is the only one who advises me. WWE is mine. Said Drew that on Sunday, you're going to have to learn that you're a secondary champion. You're a stand-in. You're the guy they call when I'm busy. He called himself world famous and said years from now, Drew has a chance to be the face of the company. He will look back at this lesson. He will thank Roman. Roman said that Drew will always be his favorite number two. I thought this was great. I thought it was great stuff, especially from Roman. And it's a shame that they only gave themselves a week to really build up a match like this. On Talking Smack, Paul Heyman called Drew McIntyre a babysitter for a belt. That was what he called him. Neither man should be losing here. So does Jey Uso get involved? Does Randy Orton get involved? The Fiend? You know, what about Sheamus? I know Sheamus is in a match of his own, but what about this friendship that they have been showing us, they've been showcasing on TV now for weeks with Drew and Sheamus? Sheamus is going to be an opponent for Drew in the near future. We know this. They're not featuring these guys on TV together because they're going to be bosom buddies for the next 6 months. We know where this is going. Sheamus is already a heel. He's already a prick. So it's not that much of a stretch to think that he's going to be jealous and he's going to want the title and he's going to kick his friend's head off his shoulder. But hopefully they milk it for a little while longer. But does Sheamus get involved and end up inadvertently costing his friend the match? You know, if Jey Uso comes out and maybe Sheamus thinks to counteract Jey, he's going to come out and help his friend and it backfires. It just feels too soon, though, to plant those seeds of dissension. But there's a whole lot of possibilities here about what can go down. Here's the idea that I pitched the other day. And my prediction about what's going to happen here, which I think protects both guys from being pinned. The Miz. We haven't talked about The Miz. You know what today is? Today's another anniversary. Today is the 10-year anniversary of The Miz cashing in Money in the Bank for the very first time and beating Randy Orton to become WWE Champion. To the day, November 22nd, 2010. So it is a big anniversary for him as well. There is no way that The Miz is not either going to tease a cash-in or actually cash-in on the show tonight. I don't see... It's got to happen. It is the right time for it to happen. And just like WrestleMania 31, it's middle of the match, Drew is down, Roman is down, here comes The Miz. In the middle of the match, he's got Morrison with him, he's got a referee. And all of a sudden, this non-title match becomes a triple threat match for the WWE Championship, which does mean that, yes, perhaps Roman Reigns can actually win two titles. But now you've got some drama, right? Now you've got some drama going on here. This is kind of an interesting scenario that maybe a lot of people wouldn't have seen, especially because Miz, yeah, he's basically a coward on TV. They portray him as this chicken shit coward. But he sees an opening. Both guys have just beaten the holy hell out of each other, and they're both down. And he's going to come out, and he's going to take advantage. But in the end, it doesn't work. And Drew McIntyre, Claymore kick, pins The Miz, and it protects both guys because Drew gets a win. Roman, I mean, technically he loses, I guess, but he really doesn't. The Miz is the one who takes the pin. That way, Drew doesn't have to eat the fall. Roman doesn't have to eat the fall. You've now created a situation where there was no decisive winner. So who would win in a rematch between Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre when one of the championships is on the line, one-on-one? So I think in a lot of ways, it's a genius way of getting the briefcase off The Miz in kind of a dramatic way, because The Miz is not going to be WWE champion. The Miz should not be WWE champion. Drew McIntyre just got the belt back. It makes me wonder why they even bothered taking the title off Randy Orton, or putting it on him, rather, in the first place. You're going to take it right off Drew and put it on Miz? Yeah, if you're a fucking idiot, you might do that. So what is the point of him continuing to carry this thing around for another few months when in 3 months from now, it's not going to make any more sense to put this guy, who has been booked as a joke, in a position to be your world champion going into WrestleMania? I don't want to see that. And I'll bet you don't either. Unless you want to be contrarian. But really, the way The Miz has been built up, do you really want to see Miz? Forget the fact that you think he deserves it, because he's been a loyal soldier. Forget that. The Miz and Morrison have been booked as like the Abbott and Costello of WWE. They should not be anywhere near the WWE title. So this is a way to get the briefcase off The Miz. They've already bungled the briefcase as it is. Total waste that it was this year. And you protect both guys in the process. It's a win-win situation. It's a win-win situation for everybody except The Miz. But I'm picking Drew McIntyre to get the win over Miz. Not technically over Roman Reigns. So there you go. Join me live. I will be on YouTube as soon as Survivor Series goes off the air to see if I was right or wrong on these predictions. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Undertaker farewell. That's immediately after the pay-per-view goes off the air. Find the Solo Monster Sounds Off official channel on YouTube and join me on there, because not only am I going to be talking about the Survivor Series and we're going to be talking about the Undertaker, but I am going to be hosting the Wrestle Rumble. When Worlds Collide belt giveaway. 4 different replica belt prize winners. 4th place winner gets an NWA championship replica. 3rd place gets an ECW championship replica. 2nd place gets the original NXT championship. And the 1st place winner gets an AEW world championship. All chosen at random. Live tonight, chosen by yours truly. So you can still get in on that contest up until 7 o'clock tonight, 7 Eastern. Just go to WrestleRumble.com. It's only $1. It's $1 to enter. The more times you enter, the more chances you have to win. You can buy one entry, you can buy 10. It's entirely up to you. But I'm giving away 4 belts tonight, and hopefully it's to one of you. I want one of my listeners to win that title. Actually, that fourth... I gotta tell you, not the AEW title looks great. Don't get me wrong. But if I were in this contest, which I'm not allowed to be, but if I was, I'd be pulling for 4th place. That's what I would love to have. Yeah, the 10 pounds of gold. I don't know if the replica is 10 pounds, but get the classic NWA World Championship. I'd probably be jumping up and down if I came in 4th. There's also, by the way, a Survivor Series pick'em contest that Wrestle Rumble is also doing. I'm not going to be picking the winners for that, but you can buy an entry. One entry is $10. First place winner wins $500 cash. Second place is $250. And third place winner gets $100. And it goes by who gets the most points. And you win points based on answering a series of questions when you buy your entry. So, for example, and they'll all be Survivor Series related. Who do you think is going to win this match? How many eliminations for this brand? Stuff like that. So there is also the Pick'em contest that you can enter, and winners will be announced this Tuesday, November 24th. That is when the winners will be announced. So go ahead, enter one contest, enter both of them, but the place to go to do all of that is WrestleRumble.com. We've got some more notes on WWE's firing of Zelina Vega, which has continued to be a big story. And it was not only an issue of her Twitch and continuing to run her Twitch account. You know, I keep seeing all these things about how she basically... And I know she told her viewers in late October that this may be it, or I'm going to have to stop. When I had gone on her Twitch account, though, the day that she got fired, there were recent streams in the days that preceded that. So I'm not so sure that she did stop streaming on there, unless somebody else was using her account to stream. I don't know if there's other people who are part of her streams or not. So I'm not sure that she really ever did stop twitching, if that's the right way to put it. But it wasn't just the issue of the Twitch account. I also mentioned when I talked about this last week that she had opened an OnlyFans account. And she had opened an OnlyFans account for a $30 monthly subscription fee. This, according to Justin Barrasso of Sports Illustrated, is what really was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back with WWE, where they felt, okay, we have to take action here. And WWE confirmed that she was terminated for breaching her contract. They felt that they had to take action to set an example. It's exactly what we all thought, to make an example out of her, to basically scare other people into doing the right thing and following the rules and following the policy, and just to show them, hey, this is not just lip service. We really mean what we say. You better follow the policy or else. You know, your job can be in jeopardy just like hers. Unless, of course, you're a Roman Reigns or a Randy Orton, which, different rules for different people. But if you're Zelina Vega, you're just not going to be able to get away with something like that. If you were an Aleister Black, you wouldn't be able to get away with something like that. Now, per The Observer, a source in the company said that Vega was informed of her dismissal backstage, which we knew. She got to the building, she was at the show that night, had no idea that that would be her final night. And so what the way this all played out was, Mark Carano, who is the head of talent relations, walked into what I assume was her locker room and informed her of her dismissal. And when she asked to speak personally with Vince McMahon, she was told that Vince, and I quote, doesn't want to talk to you, and she was promptly escorted out of the building. Which sounds rough, but that's the way it works a lot of times in the corporate world. They won't even let you retrieve your things. They won't let you say goodbye. They'll have security come and escort you out of the building. And they'll mail your stuff to you. I've always wondered, like, because it's never happened to me, and I hope it never does. But, like, if you have asthma, you have an inhaler, you've got medicine. I mean, do they at least let somebody go back inside to get your shit to bring it down to you? I mean, how does that work? I don't know. But it's very impersonal. You hear stories about that. I mean, look, I've had friends of mine who have worked on Wall Street, or they've worked at other giant PR firms, you know, in Manhattan, who, whether it happened to them or somebody who worked in the same company, but you hear these stories about somebody who went out for lunch in the middle of the day. You know, they went, it's noon, time for lunch, they're going to go grab a bite to eat and bring it back to their desk, and they leave. And then they're officially terminated while they're out on their lunch break. So when they come back and they got their food in their hand, they're coming back into the building, and they can't even get back into the building. They're told they're not allowed back inside. They'll fire people on their lunch break. That's called corporate America. And always remember, corporate America doesn't give a flying fuck about you. Never forget that. So, reporter John Alba, earlier in the week, he reached out to Gabrielle Carteris, who is the president of the SAG-AFTRA union, about her recent tweets in support of pro wrestlers, and this was her response to John Alba. She said, "Wrestling is as much about media as it is sports, and we are going to directly engage with members of this profession to help find ways for them to protect themselves. As more people reinvest in unions and as more working people are harassed by employers who don't want to protect them, SAG-AFTRA is committed to doing what we can to help professional wrestlers secure the protections they deserve." The union spoke directly with Zelina on Thursday. I assume this must have been a virtual meeting and not face-to-face, but they had a personal meeting on Thursday. Afterwards, the union tweeted out, "Powerful conversation with Thea Trinidad today. We support her and others as they work to protect and empower themselves." And after that, Vega herself tweeted, "Very powerful indeed. Thank you for the pleasant conversation and insight." With her becoming the face of all of this union talk, here I thought it would be Paige, and it has become Zelina Vega. It is sad to think about look, it's sad to think about it like this. I don't really hear anybody else mentioning this, but any discussion about her going to AEW, I think all these people think, man, when her non-compete is up, she's going to be such an asset wherever she goes. AEW should sweep her up, or maybe she'll go back to Impact where she was, you know, many years ago. All of this talk about how it's just kind of assumed that if she wants to jump back into wrestling, she'll have a job in AEW, or she'll have a job in Impact or any of these other promotions. I'm thinking that may be a bit premature. And I'm wondering if they might look at her as radioactive, because, you know, I don't think any of these promotions want to hear any talk about unions. This is not just a WWE thing. I don't think any of these companies want to hear talk about unionization. And if they associate her with that, they may not be so quick to want to work with her either. I hope I'm wrong. I think that would be terrible. But I think there's this notion that Vince McMahon is very anti-union. There are a lot of promoters, I would even think the vast majority of them, who are probably anti-union. So her standing up publicly for this, yeah, it's a courageous thing for her to be doing, but I just hope that she doesn't get blackballed because of it. And a sad note on the new Wipeout reboot hosted by John Cena. Wipeout was one of my favorite. You've heard me talk about this before. Wipeout was one of my favorite TV shows. It aired for many years on ABC, and TBS picked it up earlier this year. Cena is one of the hosts who will be doing funny commentary over all of the obstacles. He'll be co-hosting. The way that John Anderson and John Henson, they used to fill in the jokes, and people were getting knocked around in these different stunts, and they would crack jokes and make fun of them. TMZ reports that after the filming of what I assume was the main obstacle course on one of these episodes, they don't say it was the main one, they just said after, all it says is obstacle course, but they always had that last one, which was the most difficult. A contestant died after being hospitalized. The story says a male contestant needed medical attention Wednesday after completing the course, and he was tended to by on-site emergency personnel who then called paramedics. The contestant was taken to a hospital where he later died. And law enforcement sources tell TMZ that they got a cardiac arrest call just before noon on Wednesday, and medics on set had already begun using a defibrillator on the contestant, who was experiencing chest pains after completing the course. TBS released a statement saying, "We are devastated to have learned of his passing, and our deepest sympathy goes out to the family." This is not the first time that a contestant has died on Wipeout. Or as a result, or following, you know, completing a course or a stunt or whatever on Wipeout. There was one death that I know of, I think it might be the only one, over a decade ago. So this was many years ago, early in the filming of the original show. It was a 33-year-old man. I knew there was a death, I didn't know all the details, so I looked it up. It was a 33-year-old man who was on the show with his newlywed wife. So they were both on the show together. And maybe that was the theme of the episode. Maybe it was couples or newlyweds, or I don't know what the theme was. But they had just gotten married. They had just gotten back from their European honeymoon. And they did the show. They had just been married 2 months before. And he suffered a stroke. And he underwent several brain surgeries. But the brain damage was too extensive to save his life. There's a reason that they force these people to sign something like a 50-page document. I assume it's the same way. It was like this many years ago. With the reboot, I have to assume it's the same thing. And this is all to protect the network and the companies. You've got to sign your life away in one of these documents. There's a reason they do that. There's a reason that you have to sign that before they will allow you to compete on the show. You can be the most fit person in the world, young and healthy and fit, and it doesn't matter. You know, in that case, the guy was a marathon runner. but they learned after the fact that he had a pre-existing medical condition that I don't even think he knew about. And it wasn't picked up on the physicals that he had to go through before he got on the show. So this was something that really slipped under the radar, right? It really slipped through the cracks. But it was some kind of condition where I think his blood clotted abnormally. It just clotted in like a weird way. And they think that had a lot to do with what happened. But look, you just never know. The stunts they do on that show, I mean, to use a wrestling word, the bumps they take on that show, and they take some wicked bumps on that show. Just because everything is padded does not mean that it doesn't hurt. And just because everything is padded does not mean that if you get hit just the right way, or if you land the wrong way, that you can't break your neck. I'm shocked that nobody, to my knowledge, has ever broken their neck on that show before. So it's funny to watch them get, you know, bounced around like that. But then unfortunately you hear a story like this and it's like, wow, you go on a game show thinking that you're trying to win money and you lose your life because of it, which is crazy. So I don't know if that's going to impact the show or not. I mean, it didn't impact the show previously. The show still, you know, went on. I hope this one goes on too, because, you know, I was looking forward to it coming back. But to hear that was pretty shitty. And that's, I don't know how old this guy was who died, but it doesn't matter. I mean, either way, that's awful. I know we've got a lot of TV fans here, but do you hate your cable company? You know my thoughts about cable, but I am far from the only one looking to cut the cord in 2020. That's why more and more people are switching to FuboTV for live sports, news, and primetime TV without the complicated contract. With Fubo, you pay less money for more of the channels that you want. And now you can watch TV live or on demand with no bulky boxes to worry about. My cable provider was charging me well over $200 a month. FuboTV is only $65 a month to watch the same channels, and you don't have to pay any installation fees or pay for DVR. This is how you should be watching TV. FuboTV brings you over 100 channels, cloud DVR, and absolutely no hidden fees. Stream your shows on your TV or from any other smart device. They have the major broadcast and cable networks, so you can find all your favorites. And with FuboTV, you'll never miss a game. They have the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, NHL, Premier League, La Liga, college sports, and more. There's no risk to try it out. Get full access to FuboTV for a few days for free. And right now, FuboTV is offering our listeners the free trial and 15% off for your first month by going to FuboTV.com/Solomonster. There are no contracts and you can cancel anytime. Go to FuboTV.com/Solomonster for a free trial and 15% off your first month. That's FuboTV.com/Solomonster. We got some quick AEW news and notes, and then I got a lot of thoughts on this week's NXT, which I thought was actually a very good show. I thought Dynamite and NXT this week were really quality shows. So we'll get into this and then break into the history and some of your questions. Sound good? Sounds good. Jon Moxley, he revealed that he and Renee Young are having their first child. So congrats to them. But he revealed this in a most unique way this week, randomly inserting a mention in the middle of his promo on Kenny Omega on Dynamite this week. He randomly mentioned in the middle of this promo having a pregnant wife at home. And that was the first that anybody had heard the news. And according to the Observer, at 2:00 in the morning, the day of the show, Moxley came up with the idea to do a promo about his father. And he decided later on that morning that he would work the news of the pregnancy into the promo. At which point he texted Renee and he told her what the plan was. And he said, look, your phone is going to be blowing up later on tonight. So I guess we know at least one person in that company who feeds information to Dave. Because how else would he have known any of this? And per the website Lucha Central, Triple Mania is set for the day after Christmas, which is kind of weird. Today is Mama Monster's birthday, and the day after Christmas is my father's birthday. I think he he would have been 63, I guess, right? My mother would have been 61 this year. He would have been 63. But Triple Mania is set for December 26th at a location to be determined, a closed venue with no fans in attendance. And on that show, if it happens, Kenny Omega, who may well walk in as the AEW World Champion, will defend his AAA Mega title against Laredo Kid. That is a match that was originally scheduled to happen this past March. It did not because of the pandemic. However, the big caveat here, the website LuchaBlog, which is a very reliable source of Lucha Libre news and information, LuchaBlog now reports that one of its sources within AAA denies that Triple Mania will be happening at all. They say the show is not happening, that the show is off. Now, it could just be if it's a source within the company, they didn't want the news out yet, they want to be the ones to make the announcement. So there's conflicting reports now about whether or not there will even be a show. It is important for AEW, though, I would think, to get an answer to this soon, because if Omega is going to be involved, it would likely take him off of at least a couple of Dynamite episodes if he has to quarantine before and after, maybe even more than a couple. So they're going to have an answer very soon if they don't already, so we should get some kind of clarification on this very soon. But that is the update on that. Winter is coming, December 2nd. That is the tagline for Moxley versus Omega, that big episode of Dynamite. Before we get there, though, we've got one more. We've got one more episode of Dynamite, and I do hope that you will join me live this Wednesday for the new Thanksgiving Eve tradition. That being the Sound Off AEW Dynamite Review. Year two. Year number two, the new Thanksgiving Eve tradition. Now that, you know, years ago, WWE abandoned it. It used to be Survivor Series. It was the Thanksgiving Day tradition. Then it was the Thanksgiving Eve tradition. And then they just killed all the tradition. They took a 9mm, you know, or took a Glock to the back of its head. They blew its brains out. Tradition is dead in this company. So I will take the mantle. And this will be our new Thanksgiving Eve tradition. I hope you will join me on Wednesday night. Now, as far as NXT is concerned, it is that time of year. You wait for it every year. You wait for William Regal to shout those two little words, and he did not disappoint this year. He came out after the show went off the air. I don't believe this aired on TV. The version I watched of NXT, by the way, was the WWE Network version. By the time I was ready to watch it, it was posted on the network, so I just watched it on there. But I assume this did not air on TV. The clip is on their YouTube channel. William Regal came out with both the Pat McAfee faction and Undisputed Era being held apart. He walked out and he shouted, "War Games!" And the two War Games matches have now been set. War Games Takeover Edition, Sunday, December 6th is the date. So I guess I'll be going live on YouTube after that as well. But the two War Games matches have been set, one for the men, one for the women. And we will get to that. But first, Johnny Gargano had a shot to regain the North American Championship on this show Wednesday night, but Damian Priest came out and he popped poor Leon Ruff right in the jaw, although he did apologize to him before he did it, so trying to be a nice guy. But he got Gargano intentionally disqualified, and therefore Leon Ruff retained his North American title. Backstage after the match, Ruff stood up for himself. He's not going to be a punching bag. He says, look, if people think I'm a joke and they don't take me seriously as the champion, then I shouldn't even be the champion. Here, take the belt. And Regal said, no, you're the champion. He slapped Damian Priest in the face and he walked off. So later on in the show, there was a brawl out in the ring involving Priest and Gargano, and Leon Ruff came out and he got involved. I like the fact that he is showing some backbone. He's actually showing a spine. He's standing up to these guys. It's not official yet, but we are almost certainly going to be getting a triple threat match for the title with these three, I would think, at the War Games Takeover show. I thought the blindfold match between Dexter Lumis and Cameron Grimes was a miss. Not as entertaining as their Haunted House match. You know, it's tough. It's tough. I mean, Cameron Grimes, he's funny. He's entertaining. He tried to make this work. I just didn't think this was, I didn't think it was that good. And it's hard because, you know, it's hard to do a blindfold match in any kind of setting, let alone a setting without a lot of fans. because fans can play a role in telling the babyface and trying to guide them, right? They can point. And the fans can either make noise, they could cheer, they could boo, they could try to steer the babyface in the right direction. They could also try to steer the heel in the wrong direction. So that kind of interaction can be fun. It's just not the same when you've got 50 people or 100 people there, and they're not doing any of that. Grimes beat up the referee, thinking that it was Loomis. Then he pulled his hood off, and he realized it wasn't. Both guys ended up with their hoods being pulled off. Grimes ran away, so there was no winner. This is not over, so now it's on to whatever the next stipulation is going to be. And with Cameron Grimes running away, I'm thinking steel cage match. But doing a cage match soon, when you are doing two War Games matches, I don't know that that really makes a whole lot of sense. Arturo Huas returned, got a video package, and he returned to NXT. For the first time since we last saw him, I guess it would have been on Raw Underground. It must really be underground now. It is so underground that we can't even see it anymore. He lost to Kushida, and in so doing, according to Fightful, he suffered a right bicep injury that will be have to be tested. He's going to be having an MRI to gauge the extent of the injury. Is it really bad? Is it not so bad? So we don't know yet. But they continue to push Kushida very strongly, and he's racking up win after win. I still think for an eventual NXT championship match with Finn Balor, with the Balor injury, my guess is that those plans were just delayed, and that's kind of why it feels like Kushida, you know, he's still winning, but he's been kind of treading water. He had the feud with Velveteen Dream, he vanquished Velveteen Dream, and he's not really been doing much since. And I think a lot of that may have to do with the fact that Balor has been out hurt. When Balor is officially back, and it looks like that should be very soon, we might be getting the match at that point. Toni Storm and Ember Moon got a win over Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez in a very good tag team. I thought it was a very fun match. All of these women are very good, but Raquel Gonzalez continues to impress. She continues week after week to be the real standout here. Toni Storm got the roll up on Dakota for the win. She, though, and Ember were attacked in the aisle by Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell, who tossed them back into the ring. They got destroyed by Gonzalez. War Games is going to feature Team Shotzi against Team Candice. And Team Candice now looks to be Candice LeRae, Indy Hartwell, Dakota Kai, and Raquel Gonzalez. Team Shotzi looks to be Shotzi Blackheart, and now this is me guessing here, Ember Moon, Toni Storm, and as far as a fourth member, Io Shirai has no obvious opponent for TakeOver. So the champion should take that spot so she can get on the show. And she would be the biggest name to put in that spot. So if I'm booking this, I'm doing Shotzi Blackheart, Toni Storm, Ember Moon, and Io Shirai, in part because one of those women are likely going to be next in line to challenge Io for the championship. And so you've got that little wrinkle in there as well. Is it going to be Io and Toni Storm? Is it going to be Io and Ember? Io would just seem to be the logical fourth person in that grouping. But officially, we don't know any of the members of that team other than Shotzi Blackheart. So we will find out more, I guess, this Wednesday, but that's where I think it's headed. Timothy Thatcher beat August Gray. That is not a good name. The more I say it, the more terrible it sounds. Not nearly as bad as some of the really, truly awful names that have come out of NXT or that people get when they get to the main roster sometimes. But it's not good. It's not good. He is, though. That's the thing. He is actually very good. Anthony Green is a very good wrestler, and I thought this was good for the time it lasted. It didn't go very long. Thatcher gets the submission win, no surprise there. He tells Gray after the match, today's lesson is don't pick a fight with someone you can't beat. And then almost on cue, we hear the theme music for Tommaso Ciampa. Ciampa comes out, never says a word, never takes his eyes off Thatcher. Thatcher says, I got no beef with you, and he backs out of the ring. And that looks to be another match for TakeOver. Although I guess they could do that on TV. They don't like filling takeovers with too many matches. The War Games show will have two War Games matches. I figure three more matches, And that's probably it. But it looks like Thatcher and Ciampa might be one of them. Wade Barrett, by the way, he's going to be off the show this Wednesday. I don't know where he's going to be, but he will not be on NXT this week. But in his place, on commentary alongside Vic Joseph, will be the former NXT champion and lover of cats, Kevin Owens, back on NXT this week. Vic Joseph was talking about the recent storyline involving Boa. And the segment from a recent NXT episode where this older Asian man came walking out and he put some kind of black marking on Boa's hand and then he walked away and we don't know what it said, if it was a Chinese character or what it was. We were told here that the mystery man, I guess, is called Shifu, which translates to master, so we'll just call him Master. William Regal was shown earlier in the day knocking on Boa's door. He went to Boa's home. Boa has not been at the PC. So he goes knocking on Boa's door, and Boa opens the door. He looks scared to death. He looks like he hasn't slept in days. Regal tells Boa, you gotta, basically in so many words here, I'm paraphrasing, get your ass back to work. You haven't been at the PC. You need to get your ass back to work. And Boa says, I can't, because she's coming. And Regal said, who? Xia? Xia Li? She hasn't been to the PC in 2 weeks. Tell her to get her ass back to work, too. And Boa kept saying that it's not Xia. She's coming. She's coming. Which, perhaps William Regal interrupted something else that was going on in Boa's apartment. And I don't know. That's what he kept saying. He kept saying, she's coming, she's coming. Leave Boa alone. Let him finish whatever he's doing in there. That's what I say. Boa's had a rough few weeks. And if she's coming, then just leave the poor guy alone. So look, I don't know I don't know where this is going. But in looking at the NXT roster, I did see there was an injury update this past week on someone who I had forgotten about, because she's been hurt and she's been out for a very long time, and that is Karen Q. Karen Q and Xia Li, I think, came up first in NXT around the same time, and they were, I think, a tag team for a little while before Karen broke her leg. She broke her leg last year. She's been out ever since. She's been recovering and rehabbing, and only recently, in the last couple of months, has she seen time in the ring. She's gotten back into the ring. She posted an update last month how excited she was. She did a flip for the first time in over a year. So she's first starting to get her legs back underneath her. I don't know if she's officially cleared yet to return or not. That must have been a pretty badly broken leg if she's been gone for over a year. But it sounds like if she's not cleared, she's pretty damn close. So I wonder if the she that they all seem to be so afraid of, not Shifu, but if the she is Karen Q. So we'll have to wait and see if the older man comes back, if he's going to be part of some kind of faction, or what the hell's going on here. I am intrigued, but again, leave poor Boa alone. She is coming. Let him finish his business. Io Shirai and Rhea Ripley had an excellent match for the NXT Women's Championship. Even better than, I thought this was even better than the match that Rhea and Charlotte had at WrestleMania this year. And Rhea Ripley and Charlotte Flair had an excellent match at WrestleMania. I think that kicked off night two, I believe. I thought this was even better. This was a great match. Io reversed a riptide into a spike DDT. Ripley was on the apron. And Io, she did this dive. There's that word again. But she did this dive through the ropes where she caught Rhea in a sunset powerbomb. Rhea held on for a few seconds because you got to protect yourself, but then she let go. And Io powerbombed her through the announce desk. So even with the little delay, which you got to have that delay in there because you got to protect yourself. I know it would have looked better if it was just all one fluid motion. I thought the same thing, but you got to play it safe. It still looked cool. It was still a devastating spot. She powerbombed this woman through the announce desk. Rhea almost did not make it back into the ring in time. She barely beat the count at 9, but as she rolled back inside, she's stomach down on the mat. Off the top rope with the moonsault comes Io Shirai. She lands right on Rhea's legs. which probably was not her intent, but at least she got her. At least she didn't miss her. And she got the pin. And Io Shirai retains the women's championship. Rhea and Io, they embraced after the match in a way that made me think that this was the swan song for Rhea Ripley. She was smiling, she was hugging Io and staring her in the eyes, and it was almost as if she was saying goodbye. And it would make sense because Rhea Ripley is someone who has been ready to make it to the Raw or the SmackDown roster now for many months. And I think the Raw or SmackDown women's roster would be improved that much more by having her on it. She's going to be one of the premier stars. I mean, if we're looking ahead 3 to 5 years from now at what the Raw and the SmackDown women's divisions are going to look like, when you look at all of the women that they have stockpiled, they're full of female talent in NXT. NXT has the best women's division in the country. In the country, I don't want to say the world because they have a lot of really talented women over there in Stardom and some of the Japanese promotions, but I think that the NXT women's division would give any other promotion's women's division a run for their money. They have replenished very nicely in the last few years after losing Asuka and Kairi Sane and a few other people, and they have women to spare if they want to send a couple up to the main roster. But I look ahead 3 to 5 years down the road, and the ones who I see at the top of the division, I mean, look, Charlotte will still be around. Sasha Banks will still be around. Becky Lynch may be back at that point. Those women are not going away. Asuka, hopefully she'll still be around. But the, from the new crop of women, from this new generation of women that they have, the ones at the very top are going to be Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair. That's why Bianca's already on SmackDown. I think Rhea's going to Raw. I think SmackDown got one, Raw gets the other. Raw is in dire need of some new faces. And I don't even think that Rhea is the only one. They could probably use a couple of more new faces. Rhea Ripley, if she's going anywhere, and again, there's always the fear. When somebody gets called up, there is always the fear of, uh-oh. But I think it's going to happen, and I think Raw has got to be the play. I mean, Raw women's division is in desperate need of a new face. And if Rhea goes there, she can work with Charlotte again. When Charlotte comes back, she can work with Asuka. You get beyond that, honestly, there's not a whole lot left to work with there. You've got Peyton Royce, I guess, but they've got to build these women up first. I think there's talent there, but by God, you got to build them up. Shayna Baszler is there. She's not going to be doing the tag team thing forever with Nia Jax, and Shayna has history with Rhea, so I think that's the place for Rhea to go. I think she's on her way out. It could happen as early as tomorrow night on Raw, I think. But that's what this felt like to me. It felt like this was the swan song for her. The thing is, NXT doesn't even need her anymore. NXT is better off for having her there, but they don't need her because they have so many other women, including some who maybe now will be able to be featured if some of the women there leave. There are women that they have that we haven't even seen on TV who are very good. And I feel like Raquel Gonzalez has slowly replaced Rhea as the resident monster on that roster anyway. She's another one who down the road is going to be one of the big time stars, I think, on Raw or SmackDown. Now, Finn Balor was back for the first time in about 6 weeks. After breaking his jaw in two places, he did not relinquish the NXT championship, which I take that as a good sign that his recovery is going well, and he will be back in the ring very soon. He says that he now has three plates in his jaw, and he called himself a bad son of a bitch when out comes Pat McAfee and his crew of merry men. He fills Balor in on all the havoc they've been wreaking in his absence in the time he's been gone. They surround him. They surround the ring. Balor said, "It's easier for the mice to play when the cat's away, but the cat is back. And look at what the cat dragged in." And that brings out all four members of Undisputed Era. They run down to the ring. A giant brawl breaks out. Adam Cole kicked Pat McAfee right in the face, knocked him down. Balor just kind of hung back and watched all of this unfold. After the show is when we got the announcement from William Regal about War Games, and the men's War Games match is going to be Adam Cole, Roderick Strong, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly against Pat McAfee, Pete Dunne, Oney Lorcan, and Danny Burch. Undisputed Era has competed, has participated in every single men's War Games match since NXT brought the concept back in 2017. It is Undisputed Era fatigue at this point. You gotta get, for the love of God, you gotta get some new people next year into this War Games match. You just have to. But this still, it's still gonna be a kick-ass match. And as I've said before, Pat McAfee, to watch him out there doing his thing, it just feels like he was born for this kind of role. I thought this was a really fun episode of NXT. And watch that women's title match, because it was easily the highlight of the week, even better than the NWA women's title match we got on Dynamite, which I thought was very good, between Serena Deeb and Thunder Rosa. But this was better.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we begin 30 years ago. Today is Survivor Series. It's all about 30 years ago today on November 22nd, 1990. Home Alone was the number one movie in America, and WWE presented its fourth annual Survivor Series pay-per-view, which did 400,000 buys and would hold the record for the highest Survivor Series buy rate until the Deadly Game Show in 1998. This show is remembered for two things. Well, three. Three things for me. It's the only time they ever featured a grand finale match of survival at the end with all of the survivors from earlier in the night. But it also featured the televised debut of The Undertaker as Ted DiBiase's mystery partner, managed by Brother Love. Bruce Pritchard was already stretched thin with his workload. He did not want to go full-time with the gig, which is why they ended up bringing in Paul Bearer to manage The Undertaker. Road Warrior Hawk, by the way, came up with the name Paul Bearer. And he came up with the name Paul Bearer while he was sitting on the toilet dropping a deuce. Undertaker was the replacement in this match. That's a true story, by the way. Undertaker was on this team as a replacement for Bad News Brown. I don't know if they ever announced Bad News Brown on TV as being part of this team, but he was definitely supposed to be. There was even a photo shoot. WWE.com has put the photo up many times before. They put up these photo galleries, and there is a photo from a shoot that he did with Ted DiBiase, Honky Tonk Man, and Greg Valentine, and Bad News has a wad of cash from DiBiase in his hand. But what happened is he had a falling out with Vince McMahon after SummerSlam when he got his payout for WrestleMania. Because back then, and I don't know if it works this way even now to this day, but certainly back then, if you had a show like a WrestleMania, you likely would not know what you made on that show or get your payoff for the show until around SummerSlam. I mean, it could be that long. It would come months later once everything was all tallied up and everything. So he found out around SummerSlam time what he made for WrestleMania and the match with Rowdy Roddy Piper. That was the one where Piper came out dressed out half black. He found out that Piper got $50,000 for their match at WrestleMania 6. He claims that he only got $10,000. And $2,000 Canadian. And so he was basically finished at that point. He finished out some of his dates, and after that he was gone. DiBiase, though, I think DiBiase was better off without him, because Bad News Brown walked out on his partners each of the previous 2 years at Survivor Series, and he likely would have done the same here. Ultimate Warrior led a team of the Texas Tornado and LOD, and every single member of that team is now dead. In fact, they opposed Mr. Perfect and all three members of Demolition. And half of that team is gone as well. And the announcers as well. Gorilla Monsoon and Roddy Piper, they're also gone. Everybody is gone. Everybody is like the Sixth Sense here. I see dead people. It's awful. Axe and Smash are literally the sole survivors from that match. The original members of Demolition, Crush was on the team as well, he's gone. Axe and Smash are the sole survivors left from that team. and they're still not in the WWE Hall of Fame. So sadly, that will probably end up being another one of those, boy, it sure would have been nice to get them in for a speech before it was too late kind of deals. I hope not, but it doesn't look good. This was Axe's final WWE match. Texas Tornado was introduced as the Intercontinental Champion when he came out for this match, even though he actually lost the belt back to Mr. Perfect 3 days earlier at the Superstars taping, but because it wasn't airing on TV until the following month, gotta keep kayfabe, he is still the Intercontinental Champion on TV as far as anybody knows, and so that's why they announced him, and he still, not only was he carrying the belt on this show, he was still defending the belt at house shows, even after he technically lost it. Bret Hart was part of that same Survivor Series match with The Undertaker. In fact, the two of them started the match together. And he was in that match despite the fact that Bret's brother Dean passed away the day before the show. He tells the story in his book. He had brought Bruce to the show. He's trying to get Bruce a job with WWE. And then their brother died and he gets to the show. And he sees Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson, who obviously have not heard about what happened. And I think, if I remember, I think Patterson made a comment to Bret like, hey, you know, cheer up. You look like somebody died or something. And Bret said, well, actually, my brother Dean passed away. And he said they just kept walking. They were kind of yucking it up and laughing about something, and they just kept walking. So who knows what that was about? Maybe they thought he was joking. Maybe they didn't hear him. But that was, I'm sure that was a pretty shitty moment for him. So he was wrestling with a heavy heart. Not only was he wrestling the day after his brother died, but he was wrestling a guy called The Undertaker. That's got to be a little eerie. But the other thing this show is memorable for, outside of the debut of Vince McMahon's greatest gimmick, is the debut of maybe his worst, the gobbledygooker, who hatched out of a giant egg that they teased on television for weeks. Is it a wrestler? Is it the Playmate of the Month? Who is it? Who or what is going to pop out of this egg at the Survivor Series? And when the egg finally hatched, and this giant deformed chicken popped out, or turkey, the fans in the building booed. Not the reaction that Vince McMahon was hoping for. He had wanted to make this guy a mascot, similar to the San Diego Chicken, that would, I guess, entertain the fans and take pictures with the kids and shoot t-shirts out of a t-shirt gun and at the house shows. That was the idea. That was the actual original idea for the gobbledygooker. And he didn't last very long. Hector Guerrero was the one inside the costume. Hector Guerrero of the famed Guerrero wrestling family, who at that time was a gym teacher. And the idea was that, look, he's a gym teacher and he's athletic. He can pull off all of this cool-looking gymnastic stuff in the costume. But nobody bothered to think, hey, can he do all of that cool stuff while he is wearing this giant deformed turkey costume? The answer is no. They had not thought about that. And so the only thing he was really able to do that was kind of impressive were a bunch of forward rolls. He really couldn't do anything else. He could barely see out of that costume. And they kept him in that damn egg for hours. They only put a few small fans inside the egg to keep him cool. He had to be in there for hours. Imagine being trapped in that egg for 6 hours in that costume. It's a miracle he was even conscious when he got that cue and they didn't have to send a team in to break the egg open, and they find his dead turkey body inside. Boy, that would have gone over real well with all the kids. Mommy, why is he not moving? Why is that turkey not breathing? Ah, shit. Somebody forgot to poke holes in the egg. Thankfully, that didn't happen. 25 years ago this week, on November 19, 1995, the first Survivor Series not to be held on either Thanksgiving Day or Thanksgiving Eve. I do miss when it was the Thanksgiving Eve tradition. In fact, one of the plans I have this year, it's just me and my brother doing Thanksgiving. We're going to play a whole bunch of the old Survivor Series shows while he's cooking. And then later on, his job is to cook. I'm going to eat. That's the plan. We're going to play a whole bunch of old Survivor Series shows. Just to get back in that feeling. And it used to be the Thanksgiving Day. At the very beginning, it was a Thanksgiving Day tradition. Only later did it become the Thanksgiving Eve tradition. But Mr. Perfect made his WWE return as an announcer on this show, still collecting those Lloyd's of London insurance payments, so he wasn't getting back in the ring so quickly. Alundra Blaze made her second-to-last appearance on WWE television, losing on the losing end of a Survivor Series match against Bertha Faye and a group of Japanese women stars. She made one Raw appearance the following week and then was fired a few weeks later when Vince McMahon decided to just abandon the women's division altogether, which led to Medusa showing up on WCW Monday Nitro not long after that with the WWF women's title that they never bothered to get back from her, and she proceeded to drop it into the trash can. That was an Eric Bischoff idea. She did not want to do it. Of course, she's the one who got all the heat for it, but it was an Eric Bischoff idea. We had the first ever wildcard match featuring heels tagging with the babyfaces and babyfaces tagging with the heels. And Bret the Hitman Hart regained the WWE Championship from Diesel, ending Diesel's year-long reign as champion. Diesel powerbombed Bret twice after the match was over. He became the first guy, really, to usher in the era of the cool heel in WWE. He was really like more of a tweener. You know, he stayed friends on TV, on camera, with Shawn Michaels, who was the big babyface. And he would only slap hands with fans in the audience who were wearing the black Diesel glove, which was smart, right? Got to get people to buy your merch. So he would only smack hands and high-five you if you had his glove on. This was also the very first time that the Spanish announce table was destroyed on a WWE pay-per-view. Now, the very next night on Raw, they did a serious angle involving Shawn Michaels. He was in a match with Owen Hart, and Owen Hart gave him an enziguri kick to the back of the head. Shawn, though, was in control. He was posing in the ring in the middle of this match, and all of a sudden, he started grabbing his head, and he collapsed in the middle of the ring, and he was motionless. And Earl Hebner is kind of looking at him, and he's kind of kicking him and seeing, is he okay? And then he realizes something is wrong, and he doesn't know what to do. He looks over at the announcers, and then he looks over at Owen Hart, who's outside conferring with Jim Cornette, and he says, you better stay there. And he makes a beeline to the back to bring other officials out. Vince McMahon, who was on commentary, puts the headset down, and he walks into the ring, and they go to commercial. They come back. They have an oxygen mask on him. They treated this like this was real stuff. They wanted people to believe that Shawn Michaels had really just collapsed, that he might have died here on this live television show. While all of this was going on and they were shooting this major angle, over on Nitro, they were airing the first ever singles meeting between Hulk Hogan and Sting. And I vividly remember, flipping between the two channels. I wanted to know what was going on with Shawn Michaels, but I also wanted to see the Hogan-Sting match. And so back and forth I had to go. This was the struggle. You don't realize this. All these newer fans here with their DVR and their cloud-based this, you take your clouds and stick them up your ass. Back then, we only had VCRs. So if you had a VHS tape in another room, then yeah, you can tape one show, and then in the other room you could watch the other show, but if you didn't have a VCR in a different room, if you didn't have a tape, all you could do was flip. There was no DVR. You couldn't hop on the computer after and bring it up on YouTube or some other site. Couldn't do it. So all you could do was flip. Hogan, the Hogan thing was very weird. This was months before he joined the NWO. This was almost like a test run, I feel like. This was a way to test the waters, in my opinion, for an eventual Hulk Hogan heel turn. He looked like Hollywood Hogan. He was dressed in all black. He had no mustache, which was even more bizarre because it had been shaved off, I think, by... It might have been Arn Anderson. It was either the Dungeon of Doom or Arn Anderson, but he had his mustache shaved off on television previously in an angle. But he was dressed in all black. And you had Mongo McMichael on commentary saying, "Hey, you're getting Sting versus Hogan for free on TV when you should be getting it on pay-per-view." Yeah, no shit. No shit. 24 years ago this week, on November 17th, 1996, the first ever Survivor Series from Madison Square Garden. No Mr. Perfect, who had aligned with Hunter Hearst Helmsley a few weeks earlier on TV. He had just started up as his manager. Hennig was very upset with Vince McMahon for causing problems with his Lloyd's of London policy. I think it had to do with, I don't know if actually Vince called Lloyd's of London behind his back and said, "Hey, he's going to wrestle," and then they canceled the policy, or I don't exactly know the logistics of what went down. And unfortunately, we can't ask Mr. Perfect, but he was upset with Vince, something regarding the Lloyd's of London stuff that he had fucked with. And I think McMahon had agreed, look, we'll pay you whatever it was that you would have been paid on that. I think they offered him a new deal. We'll make up the money for it. But Eric Bischoff swooped in and made him a better financial offer. And so he took the offer instead to go to WCW, and there was no Mr. Perfect at Survivor Series. There was no Kurt Hennig in WCW either for many, many more months. I don't think he made his debut until the following summer, because the legal squabbling between WWE and WCW. This was the show where Rocky Maivia came out with that ridiculous haircut, making his debut. I think he went on to do some things in the company. I'm not sure. He was all right. He turned out to be okay. It would be Yokozuna's final ever WWE appearance. He was just gigantic. Absolutely gigantic by this point. How he was even mobile, I have no idea. And the company took him off the road after this with the hope that he would get his weight in check. He was every bit of 600 plus pounds at this point. A lot of commissions in the country wouldn't even license him to perform. So there wasn't a whole lot you could really do with him at that point. And it's a real shame, because at 500 pounds when he first debuted, that's what they announced him at. When he first debuted, he was 505 pounds. Now, I don't know if he was 505. I don't know if they exaggerated it. And he was 460. He was a big guy, but not nearly as big as he would become later on. And he was very fleet of foot. He was very agile for a guy of that size. He could move around that ring. He was very impressive for a guy that size. But imagine if he had dropped down to 400 or 450 or whatever he was when he first debuted in 92 on WWE television. Imagine if he had dropped the weight and gotten back down to that. Still big enough to be a big man, still big enough to do the bonsai, but I can't imagine how much more impressive he would have been at that weight in the ring. More importantly, he probably would have lived a lot longer, because it wasn't very many years after that that he passed away. I mean, it was a few years later, but he died very young. He died, I think he was 34 when he died. Far too soon. Bret Hart had signed a 20-year deal to return to WWE and wrestled Stone Cold Steve Austin. This is their first big pay-per-view match together. Excellent match. And Psycho Sid won his first WWE championship in the best match of his career, the best match of his life, against Shawn Michaels, who was booed vociferously by fans in the garden that night, at least the male fans. All the girl fans were still cheering, "Oh, Shawn!" They were still cheering for him. They were wearing their Shawn Michaels glasses and the little beret and the fucking earrings coming out of their ears. But all the guys, they just booed the hell out of this guy. And that was originally supposed to be Vader against Shawn Michaels in a rematch from SummerSlam. Vader was supposed to get the win and win the WWE title. And I assume it would have been Vader then going on to the Alamo Dome 2 months later and dropping it right back to Shawn. But this was a spot, and Jim Cornette has said the same thing. He was managing Vader at the time. This was a spot for Vader. Shawn Michaels did not like Vader. He did not like working with Vader. He pitched a hissy fit, and he got it changed. So he did not have to work with Vader anymore after the summer. So Shawn, he did not take the loss very well. He did not take the loss very well. He did not take the reaction from the Garden Faithful very well. And he wrote in his book that he dealt with it the way that he dealt with a lot of things back then. He went out after the show, and he got wasted. 23 years ago this week, on November 17th, 1997, Ravishing Rick Rude made history by becoming the first and only person to appear on both Monday Night Raw and Monday Nitro on the very same night. And with a beard on one show and no beard on the other. Like magic. But it's even more impressive than that, because he also appeared on ECW Hardcore TV in some markets that very same night. It was the November 15th, 1997 episode of Hardcore TV. The ECW show aired on the weekends, but in some markets, it aired on Monday nights, late. Vince McMahon had proposed the idea of bringing back Rick Rude to the company, but he did not want to sign him to a contract. So imagine having that conversation. If you're Bruce Pritchard or Pat Patterson or whoever else, I want to bring back Rick Rude. Here's my idea. I want to bring him back, but I don't want to sign him to a contract. Okay. So what they ended up doing was they were just paying him per appearance. They were signing him to a bunch of per appearance deals, which Vince was warned against, but that's what he wanted to do. And so they brought him in as a bodyguard for DX, and it would come back to bite Vince on the ass after the Montreal screwjob. Rick Rude was very good friends with Bret Hart, and he was furious about what they did to him at the Survivor Series. Eric Bischoff got wind of this. He reached out to Rude and said, hey, let's make a deal. Which he could do because, again, he was not signed to a contract. So this was not contract tampering. This was not breach of contract. There was no contract to breach. WWE at the time was not airing live every week. I think at that point, it was 1 week live, 1 week taped, 1 week live, 1 week taped. I think that was the schedule at that point in 97. Their show that night had already been taped 6 days before. Bischoff found out that the DX segment with Rick Rude that was scheduled for Raw that night was not going to air until later in the show, and so he decided to trot out Rick Rude live on Nitro in the opening segment. He was going to set the tone early for that night, and there he was with his mustache and no beard, talking about how Shawn Michaels wasn't the real champion. He called WWE a sinking ship. Bruce Pritchard said that he and Vince McMahon, while all of this was happening, they were sitting together in the studios in Stamford, producing the live commentary for the show that night. When they saw Rude on a monitor, they saw him walk out on Nitro, and Pritchard said that the only word out of Vince McMahon's mouth at that moment was, motherfucker. So, salute to the Ravishing One, the only man to ever appear on WWE, WCW, and ECW television, all in the same night. And nobody will ever be able to do that ever again. 19 years ago, on November 18th, 2001, marked the end of the Alliance and the end of the invasion at Survivor Series. I love how the promotional poster for this epic winner-take-all, us-against-them show featured just two people. Just two people. And those two people featured on the poster, Lita and Tori Wilson. Now, I get why they would want Lita and Tori Wilson on a poster, but considering the show and the stakes that were on the line, I just find it funny that they were the only two people on this pay-per-view poster. That's all you needed, I guess, back then to sell the show. That's all you needed. WWE left more money on the table with that invasion storyline than any other in the history of the company. This should not have been the end. With the right people, just with even some of the big names, even if they couldn't get them all at once, just with some of the big names that they didn't sign, who eventually did end up coming. They all ended up coming to WWE. I'm not counting Luger in this or Jarrett or any, but like Flair, Hogan, Hall, Nash, Steiner, Goldberg, they all ended up coming in anyway. They could have kept this thing going through WrestleMania and built to a real big dream supercard. But we still got Rock against Hogan, which is one of the best matches in WrestleMania history. So that's a nice consolation prize. The Dudleys beat the Hardys to unify the WWE and WCW tag team titles. Edge beat Test to unify the Intercontinental and the U.S. titles. Test then went on to win an immunity battle royal, giving him immunity from being fired by whoever controlled the company after the main event was over. 3 years later, he was fired. I guess that immunity did not extend beyond kayfabe. I guess it was only storyline immunity. He did not have immunity from actually being fired from his job. And in the main event, Team WWF, captained by The Rock, defeated the Alliance, captained by Stone Cold Steve Austin, for control of the company. And here's another great example of why this invasion failed. Of the five members of Team WCW-ECW, three of the five were comprised of WWE stars. Stone Cold, Kurt Angle, and Shane McMahon. Those are your invaders. The only two invaders, real invaders, were Booker T and Rob Van Dam. Yet another reason why this thing was a failure. Kurt Angle, who had joined the Alliance a month earlier, was revealed to be a mole on the inside for Vince McMahon. He turned on Austin. That allowed Rock to hit him with a rock bottom and get the pin. The first Survivor Series in 1993. I'm sorry, the first one since 93, I should say. To end in a traditional elimination match was this one. This was 2001. There had not been a Survivor Series since 93 that actually concluded with an actual Survivor Series match, which is kind of crazy. And if you can believe it, it was the first time that The Rock had ever pinned Stone Cold in a match. Ever. Television, pay-per-view, live events, anywhere. First pinfall. Rock pinned Stone Cold, Survivor Series 2001. Now, the very next night on Raw brought us the debut of the Vince McMahon Kiss My Ass Club. A club with many members long before this, I'm sure. But this was the first time we literally got to see somebody pucker up and kiss Vince McMahon's rear end on TV. And that honor went to William Regal. Jerry the King Lawler made his return to the announce booth for the first time since February of that year when he walked out in protest of them firing his wife, Stacy Carter, the cat, Miss Kitty. No big deal. Lawler only missed probably the greatest WrestleMania of all time. We got Jim Ross and Paul Heyman on commentary for that one. But yes, he was replaced by Paul Heyman, who, after seeing the writing on the wall and realizing that ECW was dead, he made the jump to WWE, didn't tell anybody, didn't tell a soul. So imagine the surprise of the ECW roster, and why that is relevant is because you had people, a lot of people, a lot of the loyal diehards who had been with Paul, you know, really since day one, who were still holding out hope and honestly believed that ECW, even though they hadn't run a show in 2 or 3 months, they believed that ECW was going to run another show. They believed ECW was going to live, that it was going to survive. Many of them were still owed money by Paul Heyman. Many of them, I believe, to this very day are still owed money by Paul Heyman. That they were still hopeful that ECW was going to run more shows. And then imagine what they must have been thinking when they see Paul Heyman's face pop up on WWE television. But on this night, they fired Heyman from the announce booth. They had him dragged, kicking and screaming from the ring, making way for Lawler to return. And Ric Flair made his first appearance on WWE television since 1993, announcing that he and Vince McMahon were now business partners. And Stone Cold Steve Austin was back to being a babyface again after a heel run that, business-wise, was a complete and utter failure. Creatively, there were aspects of it that I enjoyed. I love the comedy stuff with him and Vince and Kurt Angle. He only did that because he was hurt. Couldn't wrestle. He got hurt at the King of the Ring. And so what are you going to do with Stone Cold? Well, let's do some comedy. And we'll have him playing a banjo, and we'll have him buying cowboy hats for Kurt Angle. And yeah, it was goofy, but it worked. The chemistry between them was fantastic. But he only did that because he was injured. The moment that Austin shook hands with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania 17, that marked the death of the Attitude Era. 18 years ago, on November 17th, 2002, Survivor Series returned to Madison Square Garden. For the second time, this was the debut of the Elimination Chamber. Triple H is said to have lobbied hard for a War Games match. Vince McMahon was cold to the idea, but he did like the idea of coming up with their own version of one. It should have just been War Games. I mean, you don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Keep it simple sometimes. Some match concepts are just too good to not be used. And they kept the one, I mean, they kept that War Games match on the shelf for another 15 years before Triple H finally got his War Games match in NXT. Although I'm sure deep down inside, he would have loved to have been part of one. He could be. I mean, one of these years, if Triple H actually wants to wrestle a match in NXT, nothing is stopping him. It's his brand. He can do what he wants. But he did finally get to bring it back. This was not such a good night, though, for Triple H. First, Rob Van Dam crushed his larynx on a 5-star frog splash from the top of one of the corner pods. He underestimated the fact that he wouldn't have enough room to really stand up upright, and so he kind of jumped awkwardly, and he crushed Triple H's throat. So it was more like a 3.25-star frog splash. And then to top it all off, he lost his world heavyweight title to Shawn Michaels, which made for this great MSG moment. But it would be the final world title that Michaels would ever hold. In fact, it was the last singles title of any kind that Shawn Michaels would hold. And also on that show, Brock Lesnar suffered his first loss, losing the WWE title to The Big Show in a short match. Brock was hurt coming into the match, so they had to keep it short. I will never forget the moment that Lesnar got Big Show up on his shoulders for that F5. It is just one of those highlight reel moments that should have been in every WWE signature for the rest of time. And then John Cena came along and did the same thing to Big Show in every match they ever had. But it's still very impressive, though, to go back and watch what Lesnar, how he was throwing Big Show around, especially if he was hurt, which I didn't realize at the time that he was injured coming into the match. I think his ribs were all busted up, and he was, this guy's 500 pounds. Big Show was big back then, and he, or 450, whatever he was, and he's throwing this guy around, belly-to-belly suplex, and picking him up for an F5. That will never not be impressive to me. Paul Heyman turned on his client, and he aligned with Big Show to help him win the title, and Heyman should never, ever do that again. When Brock eventually comes back, and you know he will, he and Heyman should be kept together. You cannot split them up. You can tease it, but you cannot split them up. Never again. Now, the original idea for Survivor Series was to bring back Hulk Hogan for a rematch with Brock. Hogan put Lesnar over in a bear hug on TV the week before SummerSlam. And I believe it was Vince McMahon's idea that Brock would beat Hogan again. They would do it in the Garden. They would do it at Survivor Series. And Brock would win as a way to kind of really cement him once and for all. But Hogan had no interest in being jobbed out twice. I think Hogan figured, yeah, I'm down for the match, but I gotta win, brother. That don't work for me, brother. Hogan didn't like the idea of losing twice. to Brock Lesnar. And so that plan went out the window, and Hogan, he eventually came back, but he didn't come back for many more months. And, I mean, Hogan actually, think about this. I understand Hogan, he is a very big name, and he thinks very highly of himself, and look, rightfully so. But imagine, like, Hogan actually thought that he would beat Brock Lesnar, the young, up-and-coming monster champion. I mean, maybe the Madison Square Garden crowd would have gone for it that night. I honestly don't think they would have. Maybe they would have. Maybe they would have popped. Maybe they would have wanted to see Hogan beat Lesnar. But that would have been a terrible decision. 10 years ago, on November 22nd, 2010, The Miz cashed in his Money in the Bank on Raw, beating Randy Orton to become WWE Champion after Orton had just wrestled Wade Barrett in a rematch from Survivor Series the night before. Will history repeat itself tonight at Survivor Series, 10 years later? It'll be a shame if it does, and Angry Miz Girl is not there to recreate the moment. But they have no fans in the Thunderdome, right? So I guess it doesn't matter anyway. 9 years ago, I told you this was a big week. This was a gigantic week. We only got two left, though. 9 years ago this week, on November 20th, 2011, I had the pleasure of attending my very first Survivor Series live from Madison Square Garden, which featured CM Punk beating Alberto Del Rio to kick off his 434-day reign as WWE Champion, and the return of The Rock, his in-ring return for the first time since WrestleMania 20 in that very same building, tagging with John Cena against The Miz and R-Truth, who split up on Raw the next night. And the day after that, R-Truth was suspended for violating the wellness policy. And just like that, the awesome truth was no more. The Miz headlined WrestleMania and Survivor Series in the same year. And both times it was, if you really think about it, both times it was only to further the program between John Cena and The Rock. That is the only reason. That's the only, I mean, The Miz was like an afterthought. He was in the WrestleMania main event, but he was a complete afterthought because all people were waiting for was for The Rock to get involved, which he eventually did. In fact, Rock left Miz laying when the match was over. And then at Survivor Series, Rock and Cena just needed two bodies to beat. So, you know, The Miz can always claim, man, I headlined WrestleMania that year. I headlined Survivor Series in the Garden against The Rock. But just everything, you know, context is important here. It's not as if they really thought that highly of The Miz, other than just we need it. You know, The Miz is the perfect person to put in this situation. But really, it's about Cena and The Rock. It's not about The Miz. But the other thing I will never forget about that night is how over Zack Ryder was. And Zack Ryder was not even scheduled for the show. That was a big mistake that they made. They had Dolph Ziggler against John Morrison. Morrison was leaving. That was his last match. And they had Morrison against Ziggler for the U.S. title. And after the match, they had Ryder do a run-in. He got a big pop. And he did beat Dolph for the belt the following month at, I guess that would have been TLC. But they should have pulled the trigger that night. There should have been a United States Championship match in the Garden that night, in his backyard. Zack Ryder goes over, wins the title from Dolph. It would have been a huge moment. When the show was over and The Rock was cutting a promo for the live audience, he was drowned out by chants of Zack Ryder. I can't even fathom that happening here in 2020. But in 2011, Ryder got himself over with that Z True Long Island Story YouTube show, and he was over like Rover. And The Rock is back for the first time in 8 years, and he can't even hear himself speak because people are chanting Zack Ryder's name. He had to stop the promo and put Ryder over just to make sure that the fans kind of cooperated and didn't turn on him. That's how over Zack Ryder was at that time. Big mistake, not doing the match that night. And finally, 8 years ago this week on November 18th, 2012, The Shield made its debut at Survivor Series, interfering in a triple threat main event for the title between John Cena, CM Punk, and Ryback, helping Punk retain his title. Now, as Punk tells the story, after he turned heel that summer, WWE wanted to give him his own heel stable. and they wanted the Big Show to be his heater, which is just a fancy way of saying the Big Show basically would be his bodyguard, his heavy. Punk hated the idea. He loves Big Show. He's always said, I love the Big Show, but I hated that idea. So then they suggested, well, we'll put Daniel Bryan with you. And Punk didn't like that either. He felt that it would be better for them to wrestle each other again at some point. Like, and it could be like this generation's Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. That's how he kind of described it. Punk takes credit instead for the idea that he pitched of having three guys brought up from FCW. Let's bring up three new guys who have not been on TV before, who people have not been exposed to. We can get over some new stars and they can work with me and I can work with them. And the guys that he wanted for this idea were Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Cassius Ohno. Right? Chris Hero. He wanted him to be the third guy. WWE, they were fine with Rollins. They were fine with Ambrose. But they wanted Roman Reigns with them. And Punk was basically, his mindset was, look, I'm not going to die on this hill. Two out of three ain't bad. If they want Roman Reigns, let them have Roman Reigns. Fine. And that was the idea that they went with. And honestly, it was the right call. It really was. Taking nothing away from the ability of Chris Hero, but it was the right call to make. Roman was the muscle of the group. He was the enforcer of the Shield. Each guy in that group looked completely different. And just looking at Roman and looking at Ohno, of course they would have picked Roman because the dude looked like a star. Even back then, he looked like a star. But it almost didn't even matter because they wanted to debut them with giant plastic riot shields with the word SHIELD written on them. And they wanted to put billy clubs in their hands. So yeah, imagine them trying to like run into the ring with the billy clubs and the shields. It wouldn't have worked. It almost died in one night. Thankfully, they were talked out of that idea. I don't know whose idea that was, but they were talked out of it. And the Shield went on to become one of the greatest factions in company history. The Shield and Daniel Bryan carried those shows in 2013. Not taking anything away from Punk. Although Punk did miss part of 2013 after WrestleMania. But without those guys, without the Shield, and without Daniel Bryan, as over as he was becoming, Monday Night Raw would have been far worse. They carried the show that year. And it's funny to hear The Undertaker and Kane on their Brothers of Destruction documentary on the network, talking about the streak ending at WrestleMania 30 and how Brock Lesnar didn't really need it. And if anybody was going to break the streak, they should. They both said that they would have preferred that it be Roman Reigns. Roman had more to gain from it, they said. Even though I thought the streak never should have been broken, I think that was a big mistake. Now, they made the most of it, right? Brock went on this incredible tear. I think he did so at the expense of basically making everybody on the roster look weak. But it did kind of set him on his path to squashing John Cena and becoming this unbeatable, unstoppable champion. So the best I could say about it is it made for a shocking moment that nobody will ever forget. And they did not drop the ball on Brock Lesnar. Right? They put Brock over strong and they saw it through to the end. They didn't bungle that part of it. So I will give them that. I still don't believe the streak ever should have been broken. That being said, if they were going to do it, the idea that I had pitched years ago on the Sound Off, and I'd be curious to get your feedback. I know some people are not going to like this because they're going to think, oh, it cheapens it because there's more than one person involved. But just hear me out on this. The idea that I had pitched was for Roman Reigns to be the one to break the streak, but do so while he was still a member of the Shield. Really, all three members of the Shield would get the win over The Undertaker, rather, at WrestleMania. That was the idea. It would be a gauntlet match I don't remember if I pitched Undertaker wrestling Rollins first and then Ambrose, or Ambrose and then Rollins, but it doesn't matter. Undertaker would win the first match. He would win the second one, but it would be harder. He would be more, you know, tired and kind of beaten down. But he would manage to pull it out. And it doesn't bury, you know, Ambrose because he lost to a guy who just wrestled him. It doesn't bury him because it's WrestleMania. People just assume the Undertaker's going to win. He's unbeatable. He's like Michael Myers at WrestleMania. No matter what you do to the guy, you can't put him down. So he gets through the first two members of the Shield. But then he would lose ultimately in the third fall or the third match to Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns would be the one to finally put him down. So the Shield could take credit for ending the streak, and that could be their big thing for months. These are the guys that broke the streak. They've taken this company by storm. They did what nobody else could do. They did the impossible. They can go around and gloat about this for the rest of their lives. But specifically, Roman Reigns would be the one gloating and almost hogging all the glory and taking credit for being the man who actually pinned The Undertaker and beat him, even though Rollins and Ambrose, they softened him up. They kind of served him up to Roman, but Roman is the one who kind of goes off and is taking credit for it. And that is the seed right there that eventually contributes to the breakup of the Shield, because they're tired of Roman getting all the glory and he's the one gloating about it. And what about us? And they become kind of jealous of him. And you could have built eventually, not right away, but eventually you could have built to the Shield split just based on that, if you wanted to. I mean, remember, the Shield put Undertaker through a table on SmackDown. They gave him the triple powerbomb through a table on SmackDown. This was the year before the streak even got broken. And I think he actually legitimately got hurt on that spot, but Undertaker went away. We didn't see him again. So it would not have been a stretch for the Undertaker coming back to say, hey, you know, Undertaker is back now to, you know, looking for revenge against the three punks who put him on the shelf and agreed to just wrestle all three of them in a gauntlet, one right after the other, in whatever order, at WrestleMania, and put his streak on the line. So anyway, that was the idea that I had kind of put out there, and would love to get your feedback, but that is this week in wrestling history. That is probably the biggest one. Yeah, this is a busy week. But as you guys know, I love talking wrestling history with all of you and getting your comments and tweets and feedback. You can send me your email questions as well, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Always include your name and where you are from. I will try to get your questions on the show. I might try to get your questions on the next video mailbag, the inbox that I do on YouTube. There'll be another one of those coming up soon. You never know where or when your question might get answered. I try to answer as many of them as I can. We'll start with Brandon from Lancaster, California. With Survivor Series being the quote-unquote final appearance of The Undertaker, I feel like he will be wrestling. What if in the men's Survivor Series match, someone is unable to compete, the lights go off and the gong hits, and The Undertaker is now the fifth entrant? Undertaker is the sole survivor against AJ Styles, and we somewhat get the wrestling match that we were supposed to get at WrestleMania. And in his quote-unquote final match, Undertaker does the job for AJ and puts him over. What are your thoughts? Interesting idea. I hadn't thought about him replacing, you know, taking somebody out of the men's match and then replacing them with Undertaker. I'm not sure why he would do that. I mean, what would be the rationale for Undertaker wanting to be in that match? He's not really part of either brand. I mean, this is all supposed to be about brand loyalty. Undertaker is not loyal, I don't think, to one brand over the other. Who knows? Maybe. I mean, maybe that's why they put Otis in there. Otis is just in there to get bounced. Maybe Tucker hits him in the back of the head with a baseball bat backstage and says, "You've ruined my life." Even though he's the one who turned on Otis, he fucked up his own career. I guess it's possible. I don't think it's going to happen, though. How would I feel about it? It would probably be the best spot for him to be in if he's going to be in a match, because he doesn't have to do a lot of the work. He's in a multi-man tag team match. He can come in, do a few spots. He doesn't have to do too much. If it comes down to him and AJ, AJ is going to bounce around for him like crazy. But then AJ goes over and gets the win. Hey, look, it gives AJ Styles a big win. I wouldn't hate it. I wouldn't hate it. I just don't see that actually happening. It's an interesting idea, though. Joseph from Port St. Lucie, Florida. I was thinking about why Leon Ruff would win the NXT North American title besides the shock value of the moment. I think the plan is for Pat McAfee to beat Leon Ruff to become North American champion, and for Pete Dunne to challenge and win the NXT title from Finn Balor so they can hold all the gold, just like Undisputed Era did. It seems the booking of McAfee's group is mirroring the UE, since they are currently feuding. Do you think this is the plan, and if not, what do you think about it? I could see McAfee winning the North American title, and he'll be even more insufferable. He can throw that in people's face. Look, I have a belt now, I'm a champion. He loves to talk about the internet wrestling community. All you marks, look at me now. You know, I've got a belt. And I've been talking about wanting to see Pete Dunne go on to challenge Balor for the championship. So that's a match I've already advocated for. If they want to go the route of having all of them hold gold, then somebody's got to win the North American title. Unless they bring in another member, that somebody would have to be Pat McAfee. And Leon Ruff is somebody who, I mean, all due respect to Leon Ruff, you know, he's well-regarded and he's very good, but if Pat McAfee is going to go in there and beat anybody, I'd rather it be somebody like Leon Ruff and not Damian Priest. So yeah, I think there actually is a very high probability that that happens. Howard from Queens, New York. If The Undertaker had stayed heel in that segment on the funeral parlor with Jake Roberts in 1992, and Jake had asked him as to, which side are you on? And Undertaker replied, not yours. And the crowd erupted in cheers. Would you have kept him as a heel? And what would you have done with the match between him and Jake at WrestleMania 8? So I think the question might have been phrased a little awkwardly, but I think the question is, had he just not gone babyface in 92? If he didn't, then I don't think we get the match. There is no Undertaker-Jake match if Undertaker doesn't go babyface. But the people loved The Undertaker. They were cheering him in a lot of cases back then, so it was the right time to do the turn. People, they loved the gimmick. What's not to love? The guy barely sold. He can get beaten up and beaten up and keep coming back. He won most of his matches. Very rarely did he lose. He looked pretty badass coming down to the ring. I mean, what's not to cheer for? So they made the right move. But had they kept him heel, we wouldn't have gotten that match. As far as what the other match would have been, if the WrestleMania 8 card had gone a little bit differently, I think the top matches should have been Hogan-Flair. That was the match that they should have done. Hulk Hogan against Ric Flair for the championship. They couldn't because Hogan was leaving after WrestleMania, and Hogan was not going to lose. Hogan never lost. Hulk Hogan never lost. Even the count-out wins that Ric Flair, or the bullshit, like, dusty finishes they did with Flair going over on Hogan. Like, they were always reversed, and even in WCW, like, Flair was always the whipping boy for Hogan. So, he certainly was not beating Hogan at Mania. But if Hogan was staying, Hogan-Flair for the title, Savage against Jake. And once they knew Jake was leaving, they could have made it loser leaves town. The company's not big enough for the both of them. So that could have been the big blow off to their feud. And I would have done Sid Justice if you wanted to keep the Undertaker heel. There's your match. Sid one-on-one against Undertaker. That's your 1-2-3 right there. And then you flesh out the rest of the card, Piper and Brett, like they did for the Intercontinental title. If Marty Jannetty never got fired, it almost certainly would have been Jannetty and Shawn Michaels instead of Shawn Michaels and El Matador. That would have been a hell of a card. Michaels and Jannetty, Brett and Piper, Undertaker and Sid, that would have been whatever it was, but that would have been the WrestleMania 8 card from my view. St. Clair from Los Angeles, if you got a new pet and had to name it after a wrestler that used a complete gimmick name, so not a real name like Adam Cole, or not a gimmick real name. Adam Cole's not his real name, but I get your point. What would you name it? Slapdick. And Steve from Chester, UK. If Shawn Michaels had stayed retired in 1998, what do you think his legacy would be? Still one of the greatest, or one of the great what could have beens? I think he still would have gone down as one of the greatest. It definitely would have brought him down several notches. I still think he probably would have made it in there as one of the greats. Because look, I mean, he had two of the best matches in the history of that company. In 94 and 97, the ladder match of WrestleMania 10, it being WrestleMania, that match is always going to be remembered. The match is still talked about today. Here we are, you know, 26 years later. We're still talking about it. It's still in all the highlight reels and the highlight packages. And then you throw in the Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker, which I still think is the best of all the Hell in a Cell matches they've done. That is one of the greatest matches in the history of that company. It's a fantastic match. He had a lot of classic bouts with different people in 96. So I think it would have been a little bit of both, because he did get cut down in the prime of his career, his athletic prime. He still had many more good years left in him before the back injury took him out for those 4.5 years. So I think he would have been both. He would have been one of the greats in that company who is remembered. He wouldn't have been on anyone's Mount Rushmore, I don't think, but not too many people's. But I think there would have always been this cloud, two reasons that there would have been this cloud hanging over him. For one, you would have had the issue of, okay, he got cut down in the physical prime of his career. So he had many more good years and many more classic matches left that we were now deprived of, right? That never happened. It's what if. What if he faced this guy? What if he faced that guy? But on top of that, he had a terrible reputation. And that might not matter to some people. Oh, I don't care about the backstage stuff. I only care about him as an in-ring performer. But to a lot of people, especially in the wrestling business, it does matter. And he had a horrible reputation. He had a horrible reputation for just being an insufferable prick who was difficult to work with, who wouldn't put certain people over, and he was a giant headache, and it just, he was a mess at that point. And that would have followed him around, and he never would have had the opportunity to really repair his reputation. That second run that he had, it's like the tale of two careers. That second run is what cemented him as one of the all-time greats. He's still great without it, but I don't think he's one of the all-time greats necessarily without it. And you might have some people who say, well, what about Bret Hart? Isn't Bret Hart the same thing? Bret Hart got cut down due to injury, and Bret Hart, you know, could have had this whole second run had he come back to WWE, and he never did. It's a little bit different just because I think when Bret got cut down due to injury, it was years later. By that point, he was well into his early to mid-40s, probably. Shawn Michaels was a lot younger when he went down with the back injury in 98. So Bret, by that point, had been older, and he had been wrestling a little bit longer. I mean, I guess there are similarities there, but again, his reputation, Shawn's reputation, was not a very positive one. And I think in the eyes of a lot of people, that would have affected their viewpoint about him. But that second run, it cemented him. Think of all the great matches, the WrestleMania classics, the programs he had with Triple H, with Kurt Angle, with Chris Jericho, with Randy Orton, with The Undertaker, the WrestleMania 25 match, which I think is the greatest match in WrestleMania history. That doesn't happen if he doesn't come back. So I put it in this perspective. The second run did two key things. It showed that as he got older, he didn't get worse. He actually got better in a lot of ways. He improved because he had to adapt. Okay, I can't do some of the things that I used to do. Or maybe I'm not quite as fast as I was in 96 or in 97. You go back and watch some of those matches he had in 97 when like he came back from the knee injury and he was doing tag stuff with like Austin. The way he was flying around that ring just when he would hit the ropes. This guy was flying around that ring. He was as good as anybody in the wrestling business. So yeah, now he's older and he may have lost a few steps, but he found a way to adapt and actually become better. Became a better work as he aged and as he got older. And that, I think, is the hallmark of someone who is a great performer. But it also served another purpose, which was it changed people's viewpoint about Shawn Michaels. Changed their views of him. He wasn't just some cocky young pain in the ass who was selfish, who had addiction problems, who refused to lay down and do business, you know, when business needed to be done. It changed that. Changed the whole narrative about Shawn Michaels. The second run rehabilitated his image from the first. So that only enhances his legacy. So yeah, I still think he'd be remembered as, oh, you remember that guy. He was great. But I you know what? One of the all-time greats? Probably not. Probably not without the benefit of that second run. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com for any and all questions. Don't forget, starting Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern, the Pro Wrestling Tees Black Friday Week Sale. You can get 20% off the new Sound Off 13-year anniversary shirt, prowrestlingtees.com/solemonstersoundsoff. You've been holding off. Black Friday, man, Black Friday Week. This is the time to get in on that deal, get 20% off. And I hope you will join me tonight, immediately after Survivor Series. I will be live on YouTube, reviewing the entire show, the farewell of The Undertaker, any surprises or surprise appearances on the show, and the Wrestle Rumble contest. I hope it's one of you. I would love if all four winners were listeners of the Sound Off, because we're giving away four championship belts, NWA, ECW, Original NXT, and AEW. It's going down tonight. Make sure you get in. It's only $1 to enter. Go to WrestleRumble.com. And that's it for 679 in the books. 680 is coming up next Sunday. This train don't stop. We hit the stop every week. We open the door. We bring more people on and we just keep going. Like a locomotive. So thank you to everybody who tunes in each and every week and has made this the biggest and best year ever for the Sound Off. And hopefully that will carry on into our 14th year, which we are heading into very soon. Be well, stay safe, especially with everything going on. Do stay safe. And I will see you live on YouTube tonight for the Post-Survivor Series review. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Lars Sullivan, the Freak. The announcers referred to Lars as the Freak 22 times in one 7-minute segment. They beat you over the head with every little thing until you are so sick to death of hearing it that you just want to rip your ears off.
The Solemonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemonster Sounds Off.